Labour to demand full pay restoration. That and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, England have retained their Women's European Championship title after coming from a goal down to draw 1-1 against Spain. The holders won 3-1 on penalties against the world champions in Basel. Manager Serena Wiegmann says it's hard to take in what they've achieved.
Yeah, I was like, oh, how can this happen? But it happens. So, very happy. I'm so incredibly proud of the team and the staff. And, yeah, we're just going to party tonight.
Well, that's what England fans at Box Park in Croydon are doing.
Come on, England, we won! Yeah!
I said from the start, Spain were the team to beat. I thought they were going to do it. We did so well to keep defending, but then penalties. Hannah Hampton, all credit to her, she was unbelievable.
They never give up. That's the biggest thing I can say for England. Absolutely, till the end, extra time, penalties again and again. The women never give up.
The King and Prime Minister are offering their congratulations. There'll be a victory parade on Tuesday. The US and the EU have made a trade deal.
I think it's great that we made a deal today instead of playing games. I think it's the biggest deal ever made.
Donald Trump met the head of the European Commission for talks at his Turnberry golf resort in Scotland. It means tariffs will be set at 15%. Ursula von der Leyen says both sides wanted fairness.
It's a big deal. It's a huge deal. It will bring stability, predictability. That's very important.
Three people have been arrested at a demonstration and counter-protest outside a hotel housing migrants in Essex. The protests began in Epping after a man seeking asylum was charged with allegedly trying to kiss a 14-year-old girl. A murder investigation's underway in West Yorkshire after the arrest of a suspected armed robber led police to a woman's body in a house. Officers arrested the 37-year-old man at a supermarket in Dewsbury. The police are looking for two other people. Counter-terror police are examining videos online after a disturbance on an EasyJet flight from Luton to Glasgow. LBC's Sarah McCallum has the details.
When the plane touched down in Glasgow on Sunday morning, officers boarded the aircraft and arrested a 41-year-old man. Police Scotland say they believe the incident was contained and nobody else was involved. EasyJet has said the safety and well-being of customers and crew is always their highest priority.
And Luke Little has been crowned the Darts World Match Play Champion. The 18-year-old picks up the trophy in Blackpool. LBC weather, a clear night for most, getting down to 12 degrees. Tomorrow will be dry and bright for most of the UK, with some showers by the afternoon. Highs of 25. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Matt Hewitt.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Good evening. Kemi Badenoch, the leader of the Conservative Party, has pledged to ban doctors' strikes if the Conservatives return to power. The Tory leader said that her party would introduce primary legislation to block medical professionals from taking widespread industrial action, placing the same restrictions on them that apply to police officers and soldiers. Let's talk about this with Peter Edwards. Peter is a political commentator and former editor of Labour List. Good evening, Peter.
Good evening. Well, Nick, this is a more draconian and more right-wing policy than either David Cameron or even Margaret Thatcher. You'll remember that we had one or several rounds of doctor strikes already. Public support has dipped a bit. But legislation for which Kemi Badenoch wouldn't really have a mandate and... which there isn't really any precedent in British history, just wouldn't command public support. So I don't think it will happen, but I think it would be wrong.
Well, she's presumably saying it because she thinks it would command public support. I'm guessing that she's looking at polling that suggests that the public is not completely on board with this latest strike by the resident doctors.
Yeah, and I can completely understand that because I've worked for the Labour Party in opposition, and that's a really tough life, and you need to choose those small number of windows to have any public impact. And then secondly, as you say, the doctors' strikes, now called resident doctors, public support is waning. But, you know, I've been a trade unionist my whole life, and I think patients and taxpayers, which is most of us, understand that doctors want to give a good service, and they just want to see, like the Labour government, the strike settled. Labour will no doubt call Kemi Badenoch opportunistic. Many people might do the same in her position, but it's not going to happen.
You know, we're constantly being told that we can't afford to tax the rich because they'll leave. Doctors have got a skill that's in demand in every country on Earth. Can we afford to let other countries become so attractive that our doctors will leave to go there?
Well, I don't think we can, and this throws up a lot of ethical questions, maybe more than we can cover right now. But first of all, Britain shouldn't be taking doctors from the Commonwealth because they tend to be poorer countries. But similarly, if you and I and your listeners are, through taxes, paying for the training of doctors in the UK, regardless of nationality, then we should ensure they stay in the UK for a set period. Maybe not forever, but it's perfectly reasonable for us as taxpayers to invest in training doctors. That's in our self-interest. But we also need to ensure they stay here. And I think that's why settling the strikes is important.
Do you think that the way that this strike is being framed by politicians like Badenoch and the right-wing press makes it sound as though the doctors are actually asking for more than they are? Because if you break it down into pounds per hour, the BMA is asking for about £4 per hour more, which makes about £28 an hour, which doesn't sound as big a pay rise as if you put it in percentage terms.
That's why I don't want to be too ideological about this, because I've been in my former life as a newspaper reporter. I went on strike, and you do that because you're angry and frustrated and because you don't feel valued economically. But the thing is, junior doctors or resident doctors are asking for pay restoration. And I can't think of one industry where pay goes back to the levels of 5 or 10 years ago in real terms. You know, other than Premier League footballers, but the NHS and teachers and journalists and small business owners. I can't think of anyone whose pay in real terms is the same or better. Britain is going through a very tough period, and I think we all appreciate doctors in the NHS hugely, but we just perhaps want to see a little bit more realism.
In what way do you mean realism? From who? Who should be more realistic?
Realism from the two leaders of the negotiating doctors' union and rank and file members. And it is around this point, pay restoration, you know, whether we're talking about bricklayers or teachers or journalists, many of us have seen our pay decline a bit in real terms. So that means going up in cash terms, but not keeping rate with the increase in prices. So why should doctors be singled out, even though the work they do is clearly life-saving?
Do you think that some of the reaction against this is because of the very thing that you've just mentioned, that a lot of people have lost money in, you know, particularly over COVID, their wages haven't kept up with inflation, and they see doctors getting this big pay rise, and they think that, well, that's doctors being greedy. To my mind, it's less an argument that doctors should be paid less and more an argument that everybody else should be paid more.
Well, it's great to hear you say that, but we've got to be able to pay for it. It's obviously someone running a small business, they can do what they like, subject to profitability. But we all know the public sector finances are in a very poor position. And to be frank and to be honest, we haven't yet had the growth that Labour really hoped to deliver in year one. Now, I think they will turn things around, and it's going to take time. But the economy, whether it's dipping between just over 0% or just under 0%, it's relatively flat. So, of course, the tax take is a bit lower, but the public finances are not going to change anytime soon. That's the backdrop, and it's a bit of a horrible one.
Yeah, however, I mean, if you put yourself in the position of the doctors, they are being asked to have faith that at some point in the future, the government will restore their pay in real terms. It's all a bit of a vague notion to hold on to, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I think that's the position for the rest of the economy as well. And, you know, it's completely understandable that a doctor judges his or her salary in isolation. They've got a family and a house and no doubt bills to pay. But that's why I gently urge doctors, you know, whose work we all value, to look at the rest of society, because, you know, is this point pay restoration? Who in real terms has paid significantly better than that of 5 or 10 years ago? We've got a bit of a stagnant economy, and most people have endured essentially flat pay or greater insecurity in real terms.
Well, apart from the people who have all the money, I mean, they've done fantastically well. They've doubled their fortune, the top 0.01%, doubled their fortune since COVID. I mean, there's a lot of money around. It's just that it's held in the hands of a vanishingly few number of people.
That's right. So Johnny Reynolds, the business secretary, was pretty blunt at the end of last week, ruling out a wealth tax. And I think he described it as daft. And there isn't really a major economy that's implemented a wealth tax. But again, you know, to be realistic, wealth taxes are quite popular among the rank and file membership of the Labour Party, who tend to be a little bit to the left of the Labour Party. And it brings to mind that period when I worked for the Shadow Treasury team 10 years ago, when there was a ferocious debate among Labour and Lib Dems about mansion tax, which never came to pass.
Yeah, do you think that the role that the doctors play and the way that people describe going into medicine is being used against them? Because, I mean, Badenoch used this word vocation. She said going into medicine is a vocation. Has that desire to be a doctor been used against doctors, using people's urge to do medicine essentially as a weapon to beat them into submission on wages over the years?
I don't think so, because trainee doctors have a very tough time, very, very long hours, modest pay. Junior doctors, now called resident doctors, because they're kind of mid-ranking. They work extremely hard. They're very skilled, but the pay is pretty decent. And I think there are many other professions where people carrying out that work would describe it as a vocation, whether you're a teacher or building houses for the next generation or a minister of religion. So I think there are many vocations, and they're all important. And that's why I'm a bit nervous about singling out one.
But this talk of banning doctors striking, do you think that talk like that would actually make the profession more attractive for a prospective medical student or less?
To be frank, current NHS staff and anyone thinking of going into it can afford to ignore Kemi Badenoch. And I don't say that of any party political position. It's that we're 3 to 4 years off general election. Tories have got a little over 100 MPs. So this is an attack line for the next week of media. And that's kind of an understandable thing for the leader of the opposition to do. You know, but this is ultimately going to be a footnote in history.
And just finally, we are talking about strikes, but isn't it true that the only reason doctors received any sort of restorative pay rise at all was because they did go on strike?
Well, I can't answer that question. I think Labour were right to settle the strikes because, you know, whatever you think about Labour, when they came in, there were issues in the NHS, in police retention, in classrooms, and in the public finances. You had to get on top of some of these problems immediately. I think the public and sensitive to the role of the NHS, you know, is jokingly being referred to as a national religion. So it's a very, very difficult time for politicians. But they know if they spend a lot more money now, which is money that doesn't exist, which is borrowing, then that will ultimately come back to bite them at the general election. So it's a question of how much more they can afford to put into the NHS. Yes, a totally critical time for the health service, but also pretty tough times in the general economy.
Good to talk to you, Peter. Thanks for that. Peter Edwards, political commentator, former editor of Labour List. Yeah, sorry about the quality of the audio there. Peter Edwards was actually on the underground as he was speaking to us there. It's a technological marvel that we could hear him at all. Now I'm going to take a short break, then come back and talk to a conservative commentator for the view from the flip side. This is LBC.
This is LBC.
Who's a good human? Jenny is, because Jenny will always do what's best for Bertie, her bestie Bassett. So if Bertie needs to go and wee, that's what they're going to do. Even if it is 3 a.m. and it's raining cat lots. That's why she also chooses Butternut Box for Bertie's meals. Freshly prepared, served straight from the fridge, and conveniently delivered right to your door. At a time that suits you for once. Hey, Jenny.
Oh.
Ready to join thousands of good humans? Go to butternutbox.com to fetch 25% off your first box with code GOODHUMAN.
The people of Britain love their ice baths. They've bought loads of them. With the Barclaycard Platinum, they could also save with 0% interest for up to 24 months on purchases, which is a nice, warm feeling. What you buy is your business. Helping you pay less interest is ours. Subject to financial status, T's and C's and exclusions apply. Check if you're eligible at barclaycard.co.uk. Representative example. 24.9% APR representative variable and 24.9% purchase rate per annum based on a £1,200 credit limit.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
We're talking about the industrial action which is being taken by resident doctors, used to be called junior doctors, and let's talk now about that with Charlie Rowley. Charlie is the Conservative commentator, former advisor to Theresa May when she was Prime Minister, and to Michael Gove during his time as Levelling Up Secretary. Good evening, Charlie.
Hi, Nick. Thanks for having me.
Well, I appreciate you being here. Well, levelling up, doctors are just after a levelling up of their income to the level that they used to enjoy 17 years ago. What's so very wrong about that?
Well, nothing in principle. But, of course, everybody has felt the pinch and the cost of living, unfortunately, because of things like COVID, because of the economy not getting back to where we would want it to be. And I think there is a growing narrative that was perpetrated by, or purported, I should say, by the last, Labour in opposition, certainly during those living up years, where the country just isn't working. And I think the idea of doctors going on strike, having had, particularly resident doctors, that had a 22%, pay increase at the last budget, where other people within the NHS didn't get that kind of pay rise, and other public sector workers did get a pay rise also, but didn't get anywhere near that level of a percentage increase. I think that's why people feel that this is just a step too far. It's simply unfair because they're now calling for an additional 29% when the public finances simply can't support it.
Yeah, it will come to the point, though, whether it's more cost beneficial to pay them whatever they want rather than to lose them to other countries.
Well, there is that point, but then I think, you know, the counter is always, you know, where does it stop? As I say, you know, these are, having received 22% and now asking for another 29%, what's to stop anybody, given economic conditions, because of the fragility of the economy, it may be in a couple of years' time that pay rises don't increase in line with inflation, if inflation goes up, if the government doesn't get on top of that. So will that lead to even more demand for pay increases? Will that lead to even more strikes? I think we're at a tipping point now, where, as I say, the narrative around the country, and this is, you know, Tories are to blame, and that's why they got booted out of office. But, you know, that narrative of the country isn't working, I think, is something that is really cutting through today, whether it's in policing, whether it's in our prison service, two areas of where people cannot strike. You know, our police and prison officers cannot go on strike for issues of national security. I think now the debate has moved to a point where if you've had a significant pay increase, then you perhaps shouldn't be able to strike on the issue and on the reason of health security.
Yes,
just as we see with national security.
But the crux of it is, though, they haven't really had a pay rise because they're still earning less than they were in real terms than 17 years ago. And we talk about it in percentage terms, and 29% does sound like a lot of money, but they're only asking for £4 an hour more. If you were dying, would you be prepared to pay the person who was saving your life £4 an hour?
Well, of course you would, if you could afford it. But the affording comes from taxes, and taxes are generated through either income tax or growth or other taxes that obviously, you know, are all at the behest of the Treasury and what the Treasury can control. But clearly, there hasn't been the money there to fund this particular pay increase, just as there hasn't been the money to fund that restorative pay for teachers and people in the other areas of public service and in the public sector more broadly.
Do you think that all of this argument rather would stick in the craw of your average doctor who earns £38,000 in their first year after finishing a medical degree, after 5 years of studying, costing them £46,000 in tuition fees alone, and they're being told by MPs that they that the country can't afford a pay rise, and yet an MP's starting salary with no studying, no associated costs, no qualifications required of any sort, is over £93,000 a year, plus subsidised food, plus subsidised drink, plus subsidised travel, their rent is paid for, and they get £250,000 in expenses on top.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people have sympathy with that argument. I mean, the defence of... I'm not an MP, but I think, you know, the defence of MPs would say that their pay is awarded by IPSA, which is an independent body, but also, yeah. Also, you know, the other things that, you know, MP is obviously dealing with housing, with crime, with antisocial behaviour, with health, with planning. Mm. They receive an awful lot of abuse, which, I know doctors do face issues, you know, particularly on wards if they're working, but, you know, the level of national attention that is directed to you as an MP, as someone that's in the public life, maybe that salary reflects that. But I take the point. You know, there are some people in public sector and in public service that are paid a huge amount of money. But, you know, the flip side to that is that there are people in, you know, leading councils and chief executives of NHS trusts that are earning a hell of a lot more than the Prime Minister, which, again, some people would say, I think that's probably wrong, because the Prime Minister's got an incredibly stressful job. But to your wider point about paying doctors more, whether it's just £4 an hour, I think that is totally reasonable, but it's only if it can be afforded. And I think you can find those savings, maybe within the NHS. I know there's a story last week about, I think, £200 million is lost through health tourism. If that's cracked down upon, then I think that money should be reinvested in the NHS and the savings that can be made. Obviously, the Labour government have got rid of things like NHS England and other quangos that are probably lurking around that the health secretary is rightly, I think, identifying to get rid of. Any money that could be saved from the NHS, where it doesn't need to be spending money, of course that should be reinvested in the NHS, and that could go to doctors' pay. But clearly, when it can't come out of general taxation anymore because the economy hasn't picked up, because there isn't the money there, then I just think it is fundamentally wrong to be asking for over and above pay increases, and it's certainly wrong to be striking, having had the government says that the reason why they're going to pay people more is to stop the strikes in the first place. That hasn't happened, and ultimately we've got five more days or four more days or whatever it is now of people thinking that they're going to get an operation maybe when they can't, and anxiety and, you know, worries about patient care, yes, within the NHS.
Right. Do you have an opinion on physicians' assistants? Because the British Medical Association is a bit exercised by the fact that a newly qualified physician's assistant is on £24 an hour, and yet a newly qualified doctor with significantly more skill and knowledge is on £18.62, £24 for a physician's assistant, and yet the physician that they're assisting is on less than they are.
Mm. Well, I mean, I don't know enough about how that has come about and how that has been, you know, who's been awarded that salary or that rate and who's responsible for that. But that does seem to be something that, again, if there needs to be changes and reform within the NHS to reflect level.
But what should the change? What should the change be, though? Should the physician's assistant earn less, or should the doctor earn more?
Well, I think you would probably reverse those two salaries if you're still working within the prison of how much money you've got available. Then, you know, someone somewhere has either been able to lobby significantly more for the physician's assistant than perhaps the resident doctor. But just in the same way, resident doctors, who got that 22% pay increase at the last budget, got way above more than people that are working in anywhere else in the NHS. So there's clearly fundamental problems within that system that we just highlighted, and it's a new story to me, so, you know, and probably one to your listeners as well. So that's an interesting view of just how the NHS pay structures are set up, and maybe things that need to be looked at to be reformed. So the people that are the highest performers, or the more qualified, and people that, as you say, gone through that whole training program, pay should be reflected for their time and expertise, and that should be reflected in a scale and trajectory that people can get behind.
Do you have any sympathy for Kemi Badenoch, because she seems to be trying to be heard, and yet it's almost as though the Conservative Party doesn't exist anymore? It's just really not on at the front of the mind, is it?
Well, I have a lot of sympathy for anybody who feels that they're not being listened to in public life or in the media. But I think, look, it's an interesting announcement today, you know, because, as I say, I think when it comes to national security, when it's the police and prison service, people can't go on strike. I think health security is now something that really matters to people, and therefore there is a question about whether, because of the backlog in appointments in the NHS, you know, whether you feel as though you're going to be seen, you should be seen, you shouldn't have your operation cancelled at the last minute because of strikes. So there is a genuine question about that. And at a time when the public, I think, are broadly on the side of the government and the health secretary who are opposing these strikes. So she's made an announcement, I think, which hopefully, you never know, let's see tomorrow's papers, whether it's cut through or not. But she seems to have grasped this issue where other parties might not have. And so let's see what the fallout is. But, you know, when you are a leader of the opposition and a party that got absolutely trounced at the last election, and you're fourth in the polls and there doesn't seem to be much of an increase, then you've got to be bold in your announcement. And this is just one of those that, you know, might get some traction. Let's wait and see.
Good to talk to you, Charlie. Thanks very much for your time. Charlie Rowley, Conservative commentator, former advisor to Theresa May when she was Prime Minister, and to Michael Gove during his time as Levelling Up Secretary. So, are you on the side of the doctors? Because they certainly did have public support the first time around, but that has diminished somewhat. Now, is that because you don't value their time and their expertise as much as at a rate of £28 an hour as you did at £24 an hour? Or is it just the very idea that doctors are going on strike in the first place? Or do you think that perhaps they're being greedy? Do you think that because others have not had such a pay rise that they shouldn't have it too? 0345 6060 973. Southampton, hello Paul.
Hello Nick, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good, good. Well, firstly, I'd like to say that I don't think, well, most professions don't have lumbered debt like, you know, 6 or 7 years worth of university fees. You know, and these people come out of university with, I don't know, 40, 50 grand worth of debt. And what job on this planet is more important than saving a human life? We've got our priorities wrong. You know, I mean, these people deserve a pay rise. All of the NHS staff, I might add, not just the doctors, but I think everybody needs an uplift there.
Yes, MPs would say that, you know, we can't afford it, but MPs are comfortable in the knowledge that whatever happens to the economy, this supposed independent pay review body will reward them more handsomely than MPs could ever have thought that they could have got away with were they still setting their own pay rise.
Well, it's okay for MPs to feather their own nests, isn't it? You know, and these people work, you know, sort of incredibly long hours and see some traumatic stuff, you know, and they work shifts. And, you know, MPs get, you know, as you sort of already stated, you know, they get paid housing, they get bonuses, not bonuses, but
expenses
of, you know, in the tens of thousands.
Well, it's 250,000.
250,000, my God. That's just,
that's a lot of paper clips.
So wrong.
Yes.
You know, and then they're saying that these people, the most, you know, these people that are saving, you know, lives every day and day in, day out, paramedics, doctors, nurses, you know, care assistants, all that, you know, they. I mean, it's wrong. I mean, why have we got our priorities so wrong in this country?
You know, one figure that jumped out of the page at me when I was looking at this the other day was the amount that a tube driver gets. I mean, I was brought to mind by my first interview this evening, which was conducted from the tube. But they're on something over £60,000 a year. Now, I'm not for a moment saying that that job is not worth that amount of money, but is a newly qualified doctor worth half that amount? And the only reason I would suggest that the tube drivers have are rewarded to that extent is because they have withdrawn their labour. Without that, they would have got nothing. So I appreciate that, Paul. Thanks for that. Do you think that the doctors are justified in going on strike? I mean, they're not going on strike indefinitely. It's only for 5 days, and I know that there will be consequences to that. But if they didn't, they would get nothing. You don't get anything unless you ask, and if money is concerned, then you don't get anything unless you ask with menaces. The British Medical Association says that there is a significant pay difference between a resident doctor and a non-medically qualified assistant. And that does seem odd. If a non-medically qualified assistant is on over £5 an hour, no, over £6 an hour, more than a newly qualified doctor with years of medical school experience, then there's something seriously wrong there. And it can only be righted in one of two ways. Either the physician's assistant earns less or the doctors earn more. Which should it be? 034, I mean, both will be attending to you at your weakest and most desperate moment. Which would you like, them to get paid less or more? 0345 6060 973. More of your thoughts on this to come. I'm going to take a news break, after which Israel has begun what they call a tactical suspension of military operations for humanitarian purposes. That's in Gaza, as countries start airdropping emergency supplies into the region. We're going to be speaking to a former State Department Middle East advisor in both the Republican and Democrat administrations in the US, Aaron Miller, to find out how this is working after the break. 10:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
England have retained their Women's European Championship title after coming from a goal down to draw 1-1 against Spain. The holders won 3-1 on penalties against the world champions in Basel. The King and Prime Minister are offering congratulations. There'll be a victory parade on Tuesday. The US and the EU have made a trade deal, the biggest deal ever made, according to Donald Trump. He met the head of the European Commission for talks at his Turnberry Golf Resort in Ayrshire. And a murder investigation has been launched after the arrest of a suspected armed robber led the police to find the body of a woman inside a home in West Yorkshire. Police believe there are potentially two more people, a man and a woman, who may have come to harm in the Dewsbury area. LBC weather, a clear night for most, getting down to 12 degrees, dry and bright for most of the UK to start with tomorrow. Highs of 25.
This is LBC.
Train to Peckham, kids in tow, rooftop cinema time.
6 packs of popcorn? I think one will do, Nina.
Ah, clear skies, comfy seats, a talking panda, clearly what we all needed. Okay, everyone's seated now, happily doing panda impressions. I wonder when Nan can watch the kids so I can come back with James. Oh, just the two of us.
Download the Southern Railway app to book advanced tickets from only £8 on off-peak journeys. Southern Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply. See our website for full details.
Protect your dog from fleas and ticks with new Front Pro chewable tablets. Easy to give, each tablet offers 1 month's protection, helping to keep your dog happy, healthy and close. Because nothing should come between you. Front Pro chewable tablets from the makers of Frontline. Available online or in-store from pet specialist retailers. For more information, see uk.frontline.com. Contains a Foxolana.
Hi, I'm Dr. Paul Abrahams, Principal Cosmetic Dentist at Smarmore Dental Care St. John's Wood. I refer my implant patients to Darwin and Tanner and consider them to be an extension of my fabulous team. I trust the team at Darwin and Tanner to help me give my patients the smile they've always wanted.
A team of dental experts second to none, armed with the very latest in dental implant knowledge, technology and techniques. Visit darwinandtanner.co.uk.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So back to your thoughts about the doctor strike in just a moment. But let's talk about what's happening in Gaza. Israel was poised to begin allowing more trucks of food aid into Gaza and had resumed supplying power to a critical water treatment plant, marking something of a turnaround 4 months after Benjamin Netanyahu's government started tightly controlling the flow of aid to pressure Hamas. Let's talk about this with Aaron David Miller. Aaron is a senior fellow at Carnegie Endowment and former State Department Middle East advisor in Republican and Democratic administrations, and joins us now from Washington, D.C. Good evening, Aaron.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I appreciate your presence. There's widely varying reports, depending on who you're hearing, about what's happening in Gaza. What's your impression of the situation?
You know, my take is that rising international pressure, perhaps from the Trump administration, although nothing in the president's or secretary's public remarks would suggest that Mr. Netanyahu was under severe pressure to undertake these moves. That combined with the reality that at the end of July, the Knesset will go into summer recess and it will not return until after the Jewish holidays, October 19, which means there's no dissolution possible, no legislation passed. So Benjamin Netanyahu, I think, had more margin to maneuver to do what is long, long overdue. His two extreme right-wing ministers are much opposed to this. They were not briefed. This was done in a panic. It also was the first time, I think, that Israeli aircraft had been dropping pallets of supplies, the Jordanians and the Emiratis as well. So this was done under pressure, but with a more confident Netanyahu that he could survive whatever political blowback there is from the coalition.
And that blowback has been instantaneous. Ben Gavir took to social media. He said, I was informed by a source during the Sabbath a security consultation was held without me. It turns out the alternative way is to surrender to Hamas and its false campaigns and to increase humanitarian aid that reaches it directly. The only way to win a war, or win the war, is to bring back the hostages, is to completely halt the humanitarian aid, conquer the entire Gaza Strip, and encourage voluntary emigration. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think it's morally unacceptable. And second, it's simply not feasible. The Egyptians would close their borders, and at risk, great risk of the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, if the Israelis literally thought to somehow violate those borders, pushing Palestinian civilians into Gaza, forced transfer, ethnic cleansing, whatever you want to call it. It can't be. That doesn't suggest, however, that the next several weeks or months aren't going to be increasingly fraught, not just for the hostages that Hamas holds, living and dead, but for the Palestinians of Gaza. I mean, the Israelis have made it quite clear that they will agree to humanitarian pauses during certain hours, but not in the areas where they're still operating militarily. I still think that there is a chance by mid-August of another interim deal. But even if that takes place, 10 living hostages, 18 dead ones, in exchange for a large number of Palestinian prisoners, and those arrested since October 7th, and a 60-day ceasefire, and more aid into Gaza, and if the kinetic activity actually stops, we're still a very long way. I think this is the cardinal point from ending the war in Gaza, because no one has given thought, let alone implementation, to the outstanding issues that need to be resolved if the war is to end. Who or what is going to govern Gaza? Who or what is going to provide security to prevent Hamas or some other Palestinian group from resurging? And then, of course, you're faced with the galactic problem of the billions of dollars that will be required and the clearing efforts. 60-70% of the housing stock in Gaza has been destroyed. How is reconstruction going to occur? And none of this is anywhere near implementation.
As far as the practical realities of getting aid in at the moment, the UN says there's 120 trucks of aid are needed for basic human needs every day. How many have been allowed in recently?
I don't know what the count is. I think that 120 is way undercounted, though. I mean, October 6th, you needed 600 trucks. And that was a population that was nowhere near as fraught in terms of its vulnerabilities to disease, the absence of potable water, the lack of sanitation, the absence of proper medical care, and now malnutrition, even starvation. I mean, you're not dealing just with feeding people. You're now going to be dealing with the health problems that have accrued from not feeding them. So I think they're going to need more than 120 trucks. January to March, when there actually was a ceasefire, I think that number climbed up to 400 or 500 trucks. And it was distributed at hundreds of points within Gaza, which is, what, roughly twice the size of the District of Columbia. The way the Israelis and the Americans have concocted this new distribution system, which started functioning in May, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, extraordinary name for something that, yeah, they've delivered 80 million meals. That's enough for one person a day, one meal a day. And you've seen the scenes of desperate people with Israeli forces positioned nearby, open for literally minutes at a time, mad rushes. Israelis, according to Israeli reports and others, firing tank shells into unarmed Palestinian populations. This whole issue of humanitarian aid, if you want to fight a counterinsurgency, if you want to deny Hamas the legitimacy and the authority that it still has, you need to be, you can't alienate the local population. And this required a strategy, some sort of strategy, which simply has never been implemented. So again, I think you're dealing with a situation where maybe in the next several months you can envision another interim arrangement, but I just don't see how you reconcile Hamas's objectives, which are survival, and they will retain those hostages as long as they do not have assurances that the war will end and Israeli forces will be at least deployed to a buffer zone. And that is not compatible with what the current Israeli government wants, which is the continuation of the war and total victory over Hamas, which means what, as the prime minister defines it? It's the expulsion of the senior leadership, those they haven't killed, and it's the organization's disarmament. So this is, again, this is a long way from Tipperary.
Yeah, just on that, I read in El Pais newspaper, the Israeli Defense Forces estimate that Hamas has around 40,000 fighters at the moment. Well, this was as of May. That's about the same number as the Israeli Defense Forces said existed before the start of the war.
Yeah, I mean, Secretary of State Blinken in December at the Atlanta Council said, the remark got a lot of play, that Hamas has replaced as many fighters as the Israelis have taken off the battle space. I don't think these are the organized recruits of battalions. I think command and control has broken down. I think these are younger recruits. But I think your point is well taken. Hamas is no longer a military organization with the capacity to pull off what they pulled off on October 7th. But it is an insurgency. And even though it's much weakened in the eyes of Palestinian population in Gaza, it still is the most formidable political force. And you can't beat something with nothing. And no one has even begun to figure out who or what is going to govern Gaza. If, in fact, there is an end to the war. Mahmoud Abbas, an 89-year-old authoritarian, nepotistic leader controlling, 40% of the West Bank and with single-digit popularity in terms of reliable polls that have been taken. The issue of leadership on the Palestinian side is acute. And Palestinians are faced with an unpalatable choice, Hamas on one hand or Mahmoud Abbas on the other, and they won't get an opportunity to choose because the thought of having an election, which is critically important, I think, in rebuilding a credible Palestinian national movement is almost impossible to imagine anytime soon.
Israelis have a similar problem, though, don't they? Because they have an unpopular leader whose interest it is to continue this war almost indefinitely.
Right, and I think that's that. If I could default to any single factor, it's the absence of leaders. We need leaders. Anytime anything of positive nature has ever happened in this angry, broken, dysfunctional region, it's when you had leaders, whether it was Sadat and Begin or Rabin, and even Arafat in the early years of Oslo, or the former king of Jordan, King Hussein, and Rabin signed a full treaty of peace, or even the Abraham Accord countries. You need leaders who are masters of their politics, not prisoners of their ideologies. Leaders who are more interested in the security and prosperity of their respective peoples than keeping their seats. And the fact is, you don't have that. In Israel, you have an anomalous situation, which you've never had before in the history of the country, of a prime minister that's on trial for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust, 4 years running before three judges in a Jerusalem district court. Keeping his seat is critically important to undermining the charges against him, appointing a new attorney general, trying to figure out a way to beat this rap, because if he doesn't, if the war ends, and there is accountability, there's no state commission of inquiry as there were, if there was in the aftermath of the October 73 war, 6 months after that war ended, an interim report of a state commission of inquiry without identifying then Prime Minister Golda Meir as responsible for the intelligence failure, Meir had to resign under public pressure. So Netanyahu has a stake. Could he pivot? He's free from any threat of the dissolution of the government until October. And then the ultra-Orthodox parties, who are very unhappy with the failure to pass a conscription bill, which would remove their constituency, the ultra-Orthodox in Israel, from military service, may decide to bring down the government. And at that point, Mr. Netanyahu will probably go to elections in early 2026. And if he were to pivot, he has two ways to win an election. He couldn't win one now. Every poll suggests that Likud and the current coalition could not win enough mandates to form a government. He's got two things he has to do. Any hope. Number one, free the hostages, living and dead. And number two, make a pivot and test the proposition that Donald Trump, in search of a Nobel and an Israeli-Saudi normalization agreement, would somehow partner with him in order to convince Mohammed bin Salman, the putative one-day king of Saudi Arabia, that the three of them could devise some basis to, if the war in Gaza ends, with some move on the part of Mr. Netanyahu toward the Palestinians, uttering the words Palestinian state, building a new coalition, I wouldn't rule it out. So it is stunning and extraordinary that this prime minister, the most ruthless but skilled politician in Israel today, has already expended most of his nine lives, all of them actually, and maybe living on borrowed time, but I would not underestimate him.
Very good to talk to you, Aaron. Thanks very much for your time. That's Aaron David Miller, Senior Fellow at Carnegie Endowment and former State Department Middle East Advisor in Republican and Democratic administrations, who was talking to us there from Washington, D.C. Going to take a short break, then back to your thoughts about the ongoing doctor's strike.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
It was the moment the music stopped at a Taylor Swift dance class and three little girls were to lose their lives.
A man has been arrested following reports of a stabbing attack in Southport.
Now, chillingly, with tensions running high, could we be looking at a return of last summer's lawlessness? As for the politicians, is it again just words and warnings?
Southport must be a line in the sand.
Join me, Nick Ferrari, next week as we mark the Southport killings 1 year on.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on your radio, on Global Player and the new LBC app.
For simple, fuss-free pet insurance policies for cats and dogs, visit petsinapickle.co.uk. For actual pickles, try the supermarket.
The Hillary summer sale just got even better. Get up to 50% off hundreds of made-to-measure blinds, curtains and shutters. Plus an extra 10% off everything until the 28th of July. Make the most of your garden, whatever the weather, with 10% off our super sleek pergolas. With Hillary's, measuring and fitting is always included for a perfect finish. Book your free in-home appointment today. Visit hillarys.co.uk. But hurry, extra 10% off everything ends 28th of July. Conditions apply.
Who's a good human? Alex is. Because today's dog walk with Lulu the Corgi has turned into an off-grid adventure. But wherever Lulu's nose takes her, Alex will always gladly follow. That's why he also chooses Butternut Box for Lulu's meals. Freshly prepared and served straight from the fridge, helping Lulu thrive from nose to tail. Meaning one less trek for Alex as we deliver each box straight to your door. Ready to join thousands of good humans? Go to butternutbox.com to fetch 25% off your first box with code GOODHUMAN.
Managing your business is a big task. To then stay on top of the numbers as well? You're only human. That's why the Intuit QuickBooks AI-powered platform supports your business growth as the number one recommended cloud accounting software. Intuit QuickBooks. Based on a survey of 506 UK accounting professionals. Verify at quickbooks.co.uk/verify.
Leading Britain's conversation. Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
On the subject of the resident doctors' strike, the British Medical Association says resident doctors are not worth less than they were 17 years ago. But unfortunately, they've seen their pay erode by more than 21% in the last two decades. We're not working 21% less hard, so why should our pay suffer, says the British Medical Association. Why should their pay suffer? 0345 6060973. Battersea, hello, Hugh.
Hi, Nick. Interesting one, because I joined the army and was fortunate enough to go to Sandhurst in the late 80s, where I remember it was quoted that it cost £100,000 to train me for a year. Now, if you join the police force, the fire service or the military, who pays for your training? That's right, the taxpayer. And by the way, like doctors and nurses, we all chose to do what we did. Conscription and slavery was long gone. But I do believe that the BMA, and especially the politicians, God bless them, really ought to come at this from a different angle. They ought to treat doctors and nurses exactly the same as those who sign a contract of unlimited liability, i.e. they're prepared to run into a fire, go to war or whatever, and say, we'll pay for your training. I don't think nurses and doctors should pay for their training at all. However, like the military and the other services, you then get tied into a fixed contract. And in fact, in the military, if you have additional training, so rather than being, I don't know, a GP, you become a surgeon. In the military, rather than being an infantry soldier, you become a helicopter pilot, you get tied into a longer contract because, of course, the taxpayer's investing more in you.
Yes, well, that would potentially fix a problem in the future, but it doesn't address the problem now.
Well, the thing I would do now, Nick, is, and I'll give you an example. Both of my daughters were delivered at King's Hospital in Denmark Hill, yeah, a few years back. By the very same team that at 4:30 in the afternoon all went, got on the tube and went to Portland in Marylebone.
Private hospital.
And delivered children privately. Now, do you know what? I don't blame them for that. They got paid three times what they did between 8:30 and 4:30. But that part of that three times their pay, 50%, went to a recruitment agency. So wouldn't it make sense to go, right, no more recruitment agencies, no more agencies, yeah? If you want to do overtime, we'll pay you one and a half. We'll pay you twice. But we're not going to pay all that money away. And the spend to NHS Direct and agencies is phenomenal. And say, tell you what, we'll give the doctors and the nurses that element of it, 50%. And we'll save 50%.
Yeah. I understand.
We've got idiots running the NHS. That's the problem.
That's debatable, but that's not a debate for today. Really? But the problem with refusing doctors the ability to go and work in the private sector is that the private sector contributes an enormous amount of money to our economy. People come from all over the world to avail themselves of private medicine in this country. And so sounds like you're suggesting some sort of differentiation in qualification or in career path between the NHS and private medicine, which would be sort of quite odd, really.
But, Nick, the only two countries, or the only two regions of the world I ever hear anyone talking about medics going to is Australia or the Middle East.
Well, that's I can't agree with that. I mean, the top 10 paying countries for GPs and medical specialists are Luxembourg, the US, Netherlands, Australia, Germany, Austria, Belgium, Canada, Ireland and Switzerland. So,
Europe's out of it, I believe.
Well, no, I mean, some of those countries are in Europe.
Yeah, so my point would be you would pay our nurses and doctors training, yeah? Just like we do the military.
Yeah, okay, I understand, yes, you made that point, yeah. But I restate my point that might solve a problem in the future, but it doesn't solve the one right now. But thanks for that, Hugh. Coventry, hello, John.
Oh, good evening, Nick, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, so I reckon we should pay doctors as much as they want. I think whatever they think they're worth, they should be paid. But they should take responsibility for patient waiting lists. They need to take responsibility for lack of service. They need to take responsibility for failures in the NHS as well.
But that's not doctors, though. That's not doctors. That's more management thing, the things that you've just described.
Well, let's go back to pre-COVID. The NHS budget was around about $120 billion per annum. It's now $180 billion. And apparently, I don't know this is completely factual because it was on Radio 4, that extra one-third is going in fees for lawyers for misdiagnosis and all the rest of it. You know,
well,
so
I have no idea. But that's also not a problem with doctors. That's a problem with ambulance-chasing lawyers.
I mean, if there's a third of the budget going towards fixing errors, there's something wrong.
Well, I can't argue that point because I don't know whether it's true or not. It seems rather extraordinary if that is the fact. But again, that's not down to the doctors. That's down to the more litigious nature of people in this country. We're sort of Americanizing ourselves in that regard. But that is an interesting nugget. Thanks for that, John. Brighton. Hello, Sarah.
Oh, hello, Nick. I really love your show.
And
I would like to say that I really enjoy your very measured opinion about resident doctor strikes. I think you're sort of, sounds like you're on their side. So I'm a retired doctor and I'm also the mother of a child that's a resident doctor. I didn't want him to be a doctor, to be quite honest, but anyway. So I am actually really sorry it's come to this, but like you've pointed out, it's not a pay rise, it's pay restoration. And so these young doctors, so like they've been at medical school for 5 years. So my son's got a student debt of £100,000.
Wow.
And that's accruing interest of 5% a year. So I read somewhere, I haven't been able to check it, that over the term of the loan, which I think is about 30 years, he will be paying back interest of $150,000. So they put a lot of money, of their own money, and they're very it's a very dedicated and very bright workforce. They come in, sort of, I mean, people go to medical school at all different ages, but the majority, I'd say, come out at 23, maybe 24, and they sort of hit the wards. They've got many patients. They've got long working hours. There's a great deal of risk. If they make a mistake, they can accidentally kill somebody. They're often the first person that somebody sees. They go to the crash calls if someone's had a cardiac arrest, etc. But these young doctors are the foot soldiers of the NHS. They're the baby doctors that in the future, in maybe 10 years' time, depends on whether they're sort of at the beginning of their training or sort of coming to the end, they are the people that are going to be looking after us. They're going to be the cardiologists, the endocrinologists, the specialists, and we just can't afford to lose them. Now, this whole thing about them going to Australia or New Zealand, Australia looks after its own graduates, and the only jobs there are what are the jobs that the Australian graduates don't want. So, you know, it's not really, there's no training path there. And so also the thing that you said about the physician's associates. So they can't prescribe and they can't order radiology like chest x-rays, etc. So you get the situation of a physician's associate that's trained for 2 years asking a junior doctor that's on less money than them to prescribe for them.
Yeah. I mean, that alone is just, that's a glaring injustice.
Yes. And also, physicians' associates and can't see undifferentiated patients, which, and that means a patient without a diagnosis, because they haven't got enough experience to see somebody safely. And there have been some, you know, some quite high profile, very sad cases of physician's associate not getting it right.
Sarah, and, I'm going to have to bring this to a close because I've just run out of time, but you've made your point very well, and I appreciate that. Thanks very much. And I think, having heard all of the above, my opinion, for what it's worth, is that they're worth £4 extra an hour. It doesn't seem too much. Now, I'm going to switch it up after the news. The soaring cost of buying a home has shut many out of home ownership entirely and resigned them to renting whether they want to or not. Some Generation Zs are now arguing that the stability that comes with owning a home, which was once a selling point, is now an albatross around their necks. And with many now swearing against home ownership for good, we'll be asking, is it still worth the effort to get on the property ladder for this generation? 0345 6060 973, Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10, Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, the King and Prime Minister have congratulated the Lionesses, who, for the second time running, are European champions. They needed penalties to seal the deal, getting past Spain 3-1 in Basel after full-time and extra time ended 1-1. It's the first ever international overseas win for England. The deciding penalty was scored by Chloe Kelly.
I actually missed three penalties in training yesterday. But, yeah, I think it's the belief in this squad, whole 23 players and the people that you don't see behind the scenes to get us through this tournament. Yeah, I'm really proud to be English right now and I'm proud to be part of an amazing group of girls.
The US and EU have reached a trade deal after talks at Donald Trump's Turnberry Resort in Ayrshire. Both sides have agreed that goods coming into America will face 15% tariffs across the board. The US had threatened to impose 30% levies from August if no agreement could be made. Israel has begun daily pauses in fighting in three areas of Gaza to address the worsening humanitarian situation. It says there is no starvation in the territory. The charity MSF says Israel is deliberately asphyxiating Palestinians. The Prime Minister is expected to meet President Trump tomorrow in Scotland to discuss a longer-term ceasefire. Aaron David Miller, an American Middle East analyst, author and negotiator, told LBC key details are unresolved.
No one has given thought, let alone implementation, to the outstanding issues that need to be resolved if the war is to end. Who or what is going to govern Gaza? Who or what is going to provide security to prevent Hamas or some other Palestinian group from resurging?
The leader of the Conservative Party, Kemi Badenoch, is promising to ban doctor strikes if her party returns to power. She says she'd change the law to stop widespread industrial action as a strike by resident doctors moves towards its fourth day out of five. Peter Edwards, a political commentator and former editor of Labour List, can't see a strike ban becoming law.
This is a more draconian and more right-wing policy than either David Cameron or even Margaret Thatcher. We had several rounds of doctor strikes already. Public support has dipped a bit, but there isn't really any precedent in British history. It just wouldn't command public support.
And three people have been arrested at a demonstration and counter-protest outside a hotel housing migrants in Essex. A dispersal order for part of Epping remains in force. LBC weather, a clear night for most, getting down to 12 degrees. Tomorrow will be dry and bright for most, with some showers by the afternoon and highs of 25. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Matt Hewitt.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
For some young people, the soaring cost of buying a home has put them out of the market and consigned them to renting, whether they want to or not. But those that don't are increasing in number. Let's talk about this with Josh Kirby. Josh is the senior money writer at The Telegraph and wrote the article, "I'll Never Buy a Home, Mortgages Are a Trap." Hello, Josh.
Hi, how's it going?
Yes, very well, thanks. The title of that article is counter to the prevailing narrative that home ownership is as good, if not better, than a pension. But you don't think so?
Well, I think things have changed, right? I think people think about rising house prices as sort of pushing people out of the market. But I think increasingly it kind of forces people to consider what else they could do. When house prices are that high, you know, the opportunity costs really kind of comes to the forefront. I think for a lot of people, sort of paying these really high prices, you know, house prices have absolutely skyrocketed, much more than in sort of other Western European countries. I think young people are really sort of looking at that and taking stock and thinking, well, maybe sort of my money is used better elsewhere.
Is that the reason why home ownership is so relatively low in this country compared to the EU average?
Yeah, I think so. And I think the problem is getting worse. I do think that we sort of have this kind of cult of home ownership in the UK. I think traditionally we've always kind of had this idea that, you know, you get a job and you buy a house and you have a family and then this kind of trajectory. And I do think that that dream has kind of been snatched away from young people a little bit, which is why home ownership rates are falling. People are buying their first home later in life. They're sort of buying their first home around 33. Just a few years ago, that was about 30. So these things are really having a real impact on people's sort of life plans and when they can actually do these things.
But the plan, from what I'm understanding you're saying, remains the same. It's just achievable at a later time in life.
Yeah, but I think these things as well, I think that, look, we live in a very sort of different world. Ultimately, people, remote working, right, has become a really big thing. So that means that people sort of want flexibility. They value flexibility a little more. People are also having kids later in life or sort of if at all. So I think these are all things that before, you know, people really valued sort of having a fixed base, having a home. You know, it's really valuable to be close to your family, to have children. And that's changed a little bit. I think people want a bit of flexibility and having a mortgage, owning a home, really ties them into one place. And I don't know if that's for everyone anymore.
It's a very precarious thing, though, being a renter, isn't it? And in Europe, I mentioned that we have a relatively low level of home ownership, but Germany is the standout exception. 52% of Germans own their own homes, 65% do in the UK. And the difference is quite stark in the rental market between here and Germany, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, Germany, it's sort of, I think renting is much more of a choice in Germany. I think people can really sort of choose between renting and home ownership. There's a much better, broader rental market with a much better supply. I think here in this country, we really struggle to build homes, both the homes that people want to rent and the homes that people want to buy. And because we struggle to meet the demand, prices just keep skyrocketing and rents have gone up a lot. But look, rents, you know, are obviously going up. I'm not denying that at all. But we're in a really interesting situation where house prices have gone up loads, and now interest rates in the last few years have also really gone up. So to buy a home is now sort of doubly expensive, because not only do you have to pay all of this money for a house, you know, the average cost of a house in the UK is now 280 grand. And sort of as far back as 1990, that was about 60 grand, that's according to Nationwide. So not only do you have to pay this much higher price for a home, but now you're shelling out way more because of high mortgage rates. So, yes, rents are going up, but the cost of actually buying a first home and maintaining those mortgage payments is also really high.
What about the type of homes that we're building? Because our houses in this country are among the smallest and most poorly insulated in Europe. Mm. So it's not really any wonder that people are reluctant to buy them.
I think, look, if you look at new builds, people increasingly are kind of rejecting new builds. I think they used to sort of make up 10% of first-time buyer purchases, and now sort of that's dwindling down to 7, 6%. I think we're really seeing people sort of look at these homes, and if you look at the kind of new builds that we're putting up, they're often sort of these kind of orange, boxy homes. There's, you know, it's kind of expected that you have issues with these homes. They're called snags, and it's very normal that when you buy a new build, you have a snag inspector come and look at it, and they can find hundreds of issues sometimes, right? And so people are kind of looking at the new builds on offer, and they think, do I really want to shell out hundreds of thousands of pounds for a house that might, you know, have all of these issues, and I might not even figure out what the problems are for 10 years? So I think people are kind of looking at newer homes, and as well as that, you kind of have this big issue of sort of service charges, right? So, you know, you buy a home and you have to pay a charge every year just to sort of access the services, and that service charge can keep going up every year. And I think people are looking at the offer available to them, and they're looking at the kind of new homes that the developers are building, and they're not massive fans. I think that kind of feeds into it. If you build homes that people want to buy and make them affordable – people will buy them.
Now, let me just ask you about this word trap that you use in the headline of your article. I'll never buy a home. Mortgages are a trap. By trap, do you mean a sort of financial burden that keeps you trapped in a bad job or maybe even a bad relationship just to pay the mortgage for fear of losing everything if you don't?
Yeah, so in this article, I spoke to a few different people, four or five young people, and they all kind of expressed this fear and this kind of avoidance of this kind of trap that they were talking about. And it came down to a few things. I think, yeah, it's a massive financial commitment, right, having a mortgage. You really want to know that you're going to be in this for quite a long time because just buying a house is so expensive. So, you know, in a world where people don't necessarily want to be tied down to one part of the UK or even the UK itself, I think that was kind of a theme that came up, was people were looking at what was available abroad and, you know, the kind of lifestyle, the cheaper housing, the opportunities abroad, and were saying, do I really want to commit myself to this kind of financial decision? And it kind of is a trap in a way, a mortgage for some people. You know, we're talking about 25, 30 year terms, and that for people is a massive commitment. And increasingly, with people having kids later and wanting to work abroad, that's not a commitment that they're willing to make.
Do you think it's a kind of a Ponzi scheme? Those who bought early made a fortune from those who bought later who have been propping up the market?
Well, this is a difficult thing, and this is kind of an inconvenient truth of the housing market, is that whatever the government does is going to cause someone a headache, right? If they build loads of homes and house prices come down, then not only are you going to have people who are essentially relying on the value of their house as their retirement pot, right? They might need that money to pay for their care later in life. But you've also got, in the last 10 years, anyone that's sort of bought a property, especially people that have bought flats, if prices come down a lot because the government builds loads of houses, they might end up in negative equity where the value of their property is actually less than the amount of money they got from the bank. And that could cause them real, real problems. And I think especially if you look at the average price of a flat in the UK, it's basically unchanged since 2016. That's almost a decade, according to Zoopla. And that's crazy. I mean, you think about that as an investment, right? We're always told that property is an amazing investment. But someone that bought their first flat in 2016 hasn't seen that value appreciate at all. That means in real terms, in sort of inflation terms, they've lost a quarter of the value of their property. So you're looking at that and you're thinking, okay, so prices can't keep going up, right? Because it prices people out of the market. But at the same time, if the government builds loads of homes and prices come down, then people are kind of potentially in negative equity, potentially losing a lot of their retirement pot. So it's a really tricky situation for the government. And I think what is probably going to end up happening, what the government's trying to do, is kind of make sure that house prices keep going up, but only sort of 2% year on year, so in line with inflation.
Yeah, if people really take on board what it is you're saying, then it doesn't really make much sense to buy, certainly not a flat. And if that
Absolutely.
Happens, if the current and next generations shun house and flat buying, then the effect on the financial industry is going to be quite keenly felt, won't it? I mean, could it lead to a crash on a massive scale?
Look, I've been saying for a while that I think the property market is due a bit of a correction. I don't think that there is the economic basis for the kind of growth that we sort of got used to in the property market sort of from the 90s up until about 2015, bit after that. I don't think there's an economic basis for that, especially with interest rates where they are. I don't think people have the kind of economic security in this country. Again, so the average price of a house in the 90s was about 3.54 times the median wage. Today it's 8 times the median wage, right? So that is just, that growth is not sustainable anymore. So now if you're someone and you want to make an investment, then you might be looking at the stock market and thinking, well, look, that's going up 10% year on year. Why would I necessarily buy a house, buy a flat, given the price is stagnating? And I think, look, people are still going to want to buy property, right? They still need somewhere to live at the end of the day. And buying property kind of gives you a stability that, like you've touched on, renting does not. So I do think that people will always want to buy. But I think the market is going to essentially sort of price itself into the right place, where we're currently seeing in the property market now, it's a buyer's market. So house prices are starting to inch down. Rightmove reported the biggest monthly fall in house prices this month. And I think that is kind of, the biggest fall in 20 years. And I think that is telling about where the market is. I think sellers are starting to realize that they have to discount their property a little bit. I think it will just sort of meet
a point where buyers and sellers are both happy with the prices. I don't know if there'll be a crash, but I do think there's going to be a correction.
But for some of the reasons that you just mentioned, and others as well, many landlords are selling up. And that could lessen the number of rental properties that are available. So are we going to get to the point where, because there's less properties to rent, they are going to become more expensive, and those who can't afford to buy a house won't be able to afford to rent one either?
Look, it's a real problem. So, as you say, some landlords are selling up because, you know, we've got the Renters' Rights Bill coming in, which is going to sort of make it much harder to evict tenants. It's going to make it harder to increase rents. And that's obviously a good thing for tenants. But at the same time, it is going to, you know, cause people to leave the market. It is going to cause the supply of rental properties to reduce. And that could mean the rents do go up. Now, it's really important the government ensures that enough properties are built, that enough rental properties are built, that the supply keeps increasing to meet the demand. Because if they don't do that, then rents really could go up and put people in a really precarious position. What that will mean, though, as people increasingly are spending more and more on rent, they'll find it really hard to save for a house and find it really hard to buy. So that should actually, in turn, sort of hurt demand in the purchasing market as well, and sort of potentially shift house prices downwards as well.
You mentioned the low birth rate. That's sort of baked in now. There's nothing we can do about that. There are fewer of us, and in 20 years' time, of course, those fewer numbers will be in the market for a home of some sort from that time on. What effect will that smaller generation have in the future as fewer people compete for all the extra houses and flats that are being built now to meet the current demand?
Look, it's tricky. I mean, I think we could see, again, this is, I think, why investing in property, if you're treating it as an investment rather than somewhere to live, I think these are questions you need to ask yourself. You know, like, with the government really, again, this government is really focused on delivering a lot of new homes. It says it wants to build 1.5 million homes over its five-year term. If it manages to do that, then that might have a sort of a big effect on house prices. Like, will the population sort of decrease at a meaningful rate enough to crash the property market? I don't know. But it's certainly true that people are having kids later in life. You know, that women now sort of, I think, average about 31 at the age of childbirth. And it used to sort of be the mid-20s in the 1970s. So things have really changed. People are really having kids later. And I do think that could sort of have an impact. And we could see, you know, a smaller population with access to a much bigger supply of homes. And, you know, that's a good thing, really, I think, if you think about it, because home ownership should be something that's accessible, should be something that's affordable. But at the same time, that will potentially cause headaches for people investing a lot of money in property now. If prices come down, that could really hurt them.
And do you think that there's a sort of, it's almost an induced panic to get on the housing ladder? Is it possible that we've been sold the joys of home ownership on a lie? The benefits accrue to the banks who lend the money, and the developers who can feel confident they can throw up any old rubbish, knowing that this pent-up demand, this yearning to get on the property ladder will make people buy anything.
I think it's really important that anyone considering buying a home really asks themselves if it's right for them. And I think for lots of people, it absolutely is. If you're planning to have kids, if you want the stability, if you want to know that you're going to pay a certain amount every month, if there's a recession, it doesn't matter because you've agreed a fixed mortgage and that's how much you're going to pay every month. No one's going to come and take your house away from you. Then that could be really, really important. But at the same time, I think if you're buying property as an investment, you do need to ask yourself these questions because things can change. I think that people do need to sort of, it's not necessarily right for everyone. I do think that in this country, there has been a culture of home ownership at any cost. But I think before, in the 90s, it made sense to buy, right? Because interest rates were quite high, but property prices were very cheap. Again, sort of four times the median wage. So it did make sense. But now you've got this weird scenario where you've got really sort of high property prices and also quite high interest rates. So we've never really had this before, right? So it's really expensive. And things might change, right? Interest rates might come down. House prices might come down. There might be sort of better conditions down the line where it makes more sense potentially to buy a property. But for me, I've personally chosen not at this moment in time to buy a flat in London, because I just don't think it's a very good investment. I'd rather kind of rent for a while, have the flexibility to move around, and sort of invest my money in the stock market instead, and sort of take my chances there. So I really think that people need to ask themselves, as an investment, if that's what the purpose of it is, rather than just somewhere to live, is it the best investment?
Very good to talk to you, Josh. Thanks so much for your time. Josh Kirby, senior money writer at The Telegraph.
Well, the values of stocks can go down as well as up, and it's not really the kind of gain that you want to dabble in unless you know what you're doing, I would imagine.
Property has always been thought of as sort of different, though. It's a reliable investment that you can also live in, and it will do nothing but go up in value. But that's not necessarily true, of course. It's just that we sort of almost straight away forget property crashes and just concentrate on the upside. But have you been put off buying a home in favour of renting? Or maybe you've been forced into renting because of the cost of buying. Do you value the freedom that renting brings, not owning your own home? And do you think maybe that mortgages are a trap? 0345 6060 973, LBC.
This is LBC.
Vodafone's new customer service is a little bit different. It's called Just Ask Once. Message them on the Vodafone app. You deal with one person and they keep you updated until it's sorted, so you can get on with your day. Walkies it is then. Just Ask Once. Customer service made easy from Vodafone, the nation's network.
Available via your My Vodafone app. Messaging service only. Exclusions apply. Vodafone UK supporting the nation since 1984. More details, vodafone.co.uk/network.
Train to Bedford with the crew for a music festival. Scenes!
Georgie, is this too much glitter?
Yep, lost them. God, I offered to get drinks on my own.
It's okay, find the flag with the DJ and cat. Oh, there they are. Back on the train, glitter gone, feet destroyed. Totally worth it. Oh, I can't wait to post this selfie of us.
Download the Thameslink Railway app to book tickets and save one third off group travel on off-peak journeys. Thameslink Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply. See our website for full details.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
We're talking about buying homes and whether it is something to aspire to, or whether having bought a home, it just becomes something of an albatross around your neck. It just ties you down. It is, in the words of the man I was just talking to, a trap. And what of the housing that is actually available? I mean, we were talking about new builds, and they are pretty hideous and unlovely things. Tiny, mean, red little houses. Angry little things in fields by railway lines. I see them every time I get on a train. Doesn't seem like something that you would aspire to own or be shackled down by debt in order to walk inside of. And do you think that a lack of desire to buy a home, excuse me, is maybe a lack of faith in the future of this country? Do you think that maybe property is not a good long-term investment? And if you're a landlord, what's the market been like lately? And as every show on TV, to my eye, that's not about cooking, is about flipping homes. Do you think that that is something that you might be interested in, or perhaps that you've done already? Buying, doing up, and selling on. 0345 6060 973. Ben in Bexley Heath says, I have two sons. One went to pubs and went on holidays and is still renting, and the other saved and has his own house at 25. Well, that's the dream, isn't it? I mean, that's the dream that we've been sold. But I wonder, I mean, I'm fast-forwarding a long way, Ben, but I wonder at the end of their lives whether the one who went to pubs and on holidays would be thinking back at all of the great things he did, and the one who bought a house at 25 and then presumably will have a mortgage that will continue to hang over him forever, whether he will rue his decision. Anna says, I think Airbnbs must have a huge effect on homes. There are over 81,000 in London alone.
really, I didn't know that. 81,000 Airbnbs. And where I am, says Anna, most flats now are sadly Airbnbs. There will be no community anywhere soon. Well, was there ever in cities? I mean, people yearn or think wistfully about some imagined time past when neighbours used to chat over fences. That may be out in the country. I'm not sure that ever really happened in cities, but you could be right. And Kirk in Croydon says, regarding the house market, there is a difference between an investment and a purchase for long-term security. Many of us want houses for our kids, regardless of whether we lose money or not. Some have always wanted a home, and it's not always about the cash. Some people come from money, and a home for security isn't the same for them. Yep, no doubt. It's different for the rich. Bromley. Hello, Louise.
Hi, hello. I was just telling your researcher about my personal experience. I'll go into that in a bit. But basically, I think the housing market's very unstable, unsettled. I think as someone who has a property, I think at the moment it's not value for money. I think with everything that's happened over the last few years with the economy, cost of living crisis, there's just so much uncertainty. I don't think there's any value in buying a property anymore.
What, at all? Or do you think that we should just pause and see what happens in the next couple of years?
I think the market will only just get even more, especially with the interest rates as well. And we are governed by what is going on with the interest rates, isn't it? So, with people's incomes remaining, sort of relative, it's not a really secure, reassuring environment to want to invest in, really.
Yeah, I get that, but I also remember pretty much every time I ever wanted to buy a home, I thought, well, these prices are ridiculous. It's bound to go down from this, so I'll just wait a while. And I waited, and they went up, and I waited some more, and they went up some more, and they did nothing but go up. So even at times of great financial strife, property seems to always be too expensive, and then you wait a few years, and it's even more expensive than it used to be.
I know, but what's happening today is that there's a market risk with the house prices falling, and you don't quite know what you're putting your money in. You don't know whether it's potentially putting you into negative equity. Mm. And there's just so much uncertainty, and the best thing to really focus on as a millennial, as a young person, is really your career, potentially moving abroad that's my sort of take on it, really. And also, if you are thinking about buying with anyone in particular, doesn't matter if you're engaged or anything like that, I would get a contract in place. I would get a contract in place. Things can happen in life, uncertain things. So yeah.
Are you speaking from personal experience there?
Yeah. Right. So we were engaged, and just like 4 months before the wedding, he's then sort of turned around and said, I'm not sure. Stuff basically just got cold feet and just walked. So I was sort of left to sort of carry that emotional labour, and obviously with the house pricing, with basically the market the way it is, I've sort of lost out. So, yeah.
Well, better to have found out before than after, though.
Oh,
eh?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. So, yeah.
All right, well, thanks for that, Louise. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Ta-ra. 0345 6060 973. Daniel says, commercial renting is on the increase. BlackRock and Lloyds Bank are snapping up properties, with Lloyds stating they want to be the biggest landlord in the UK. Commercial renting, you're talking about businesses renting office space. Yeah, that does surprise me, because I thought that we were, we'd sort of gone past the point at which people were able to work at home, and that a lot of companies were sort of downsizing. But, you know, you look at the City of London and it's just a sea of cranes. They just do not stop building office space. I wonder if they're building office space to take... not residents, what's the word, companies that rent from one building to another, rather than there's this this burgeoning desire for ever more space. I just wonder whether the space that is being created is to take renters from one building to another. Going to take a break and come back with more of your thoughts on this. After the break, though, we're going to get a weather update from the founder and senior consultant at British Weather Services, Jim Dale, about the unprecedented weather across Europe and what we can expect to see in the coming days. It's 11:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Matt Hewitt.
The King and the Prime Minister have congratulated the Lionesses, who, for the second time running, are European champions. They needed penalties to seal the deal, getting past Spain 3-1 in Basel after full-time and extra time ended 1-1. The US and EU have reached a trade deal after talks at Donald Trump's Turnberry Resort in Ayrshire. Both sides have agreed that goods coming into America will face 15% tariffs across the board. And three people have been arrested at a demonstration and counter-protest outside a hotel housing migrants in Essex. A dispersal order for part of Epping remains in force. LBC weather, a clear night for most, getting down to 12 degrees overnight. Dry and bright for most tomorrow, with a light shower possible later over England and Wales, and highs of 25.
This is LBC.
Angela Rippon, what are you doing here?
I've come to tell you about using energy flexibly, Albert.
Flexibly?
Yes, smart meter owners could get rewarded for moving their energy use, like doing the laundry at off-peak times.
So I don't need to do the splits?
No, Albert, nobody wants to see that.
Get rewarded for using energy flexibly, only with a smart meter. Search Get a Smart Meter today.
Eligibility and availability vary. Consumer action required. Reward schemes and tariffs available to selected customers from selected suppliers.
Today's the day that Jim feels he can't carry on, unable to see beyond his problems, his pain unbearable. So thankfully today, he reached out to us, Samaritans, and that could save Jim's life. Leave a gift in your will to Samaritans and support people who are struggling to carry on. Help us save lives today, tomorrow, always. To find out how, search Samaritans Wills.
Managing your business is a big task. To then stay on top of the numbers as well? You're only human. That's why the Intuit QuickBooks AI-powered platform supports your business growth as the number one recommended cloud accounting software. Intuit QuickBooks. Based on a survey of 506 UK accounting professionals, verify at quickbooks.co.uk/verify.
Brands that use radio are 49% more likely to get noticed. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org. Assuming you want to get noticed.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
So we're going to get a weather update just moments from Jim Dale. There's been some extraordinary weather around Europe, and also we'll get an idea of what the rest of the summer is going to be like, whether it's going to be good news or bad. But we're talking about housing at the moment, and specifically whether you think owning a home is actually more of a trap than setting you free, because it most certainly does tie you down, and the financial consequences of buying a home does mean that you might be stuck in a job that you don't particularly like, just because you're fearful of what might happen if you leave it. It will sort of tie you down. Bristol. Hello, Neil.
Hi, Nick. I'm just saying to your researcher, I just remember how, the 2 points, really. Well, the main point I really want to make is how ridiculous it is that banks really refuse to give mortgages when they can see that people can pay the rent, the monthly rent, and they refuse to give mortgages because they say, oh, they won't lend you that much money. It's just ridiculous. But I remember, you know, back in the early 2000s, before, you know, I was one of the last ones to get on the property ladder, I think, really. Mm. I'm about the same age as you, actually, but we lived abroad for a while. And we managed to get a mortgage through a financial advisor, and based on the fact that I was a taxi driver.
Wow.
And I can't drive.
Can't drive.
Those were the days, mate. Those were the days.
Yes, they used to be throwing money around, didn't they? They would give you more money than your property was actually worth.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. So, you know, something needs to be done because it's ridiculous, you know. And you know, later in life, we rented and we bought. We're currently living in a house we bought, but you know, people got no chance now because you know, banks would just say, why don't they do what they used to do? You know.
Well, I thought that Rachel Reeves had floated the idea of 100% mortgages again, much to the consternation of some that said, well, you know, we shouldn't really be going down that path because that route leads to disaster. But if people can't afford to even get enough for a deposit down, you know, what with the associated cost with buying a home, then the entire market is going to grind to a halt, isn't it? And very much the sort of health of the economy of this country depends on the value of the property market.
Absolutely. But, you know, as I say, you know, if you can afford to pay, you know, £1,500 a month rent, you can afford to pay £1,500 a month for your mortgage payment, can't you?
Well, that makes sense, but I guess I can understand why banks might be somewhat reluctant because they don't know what might happen with your earnings in the future.
Well, that's the same for mortgages.
I thought that's what we were talking about, the mortgages.
That's the same for renting as well, isn't it?
Well, not really. I mean, if you don't pay your rent, then the only consequence to the person who owns the property is that they just have to devise some way to chuck you out. And it doesn't affect the banks at all.
Well, I suppose so, yeah. But still, ultimately, you know, you're not going to, you know, we don't want to go back to the old days of people getting chucked out on the street, do we?
Well, no. And the Labour government has addressed many issues with renters, which has caused, by some reports, some landlords have now left the market. And, of course, that means that they have sold properties that used to be rented, meaning that there's fewer rental properties available. And the consequence of that is that the rents have gone up. And it's just a terrible situation for younger people to be in.
It is really, really bad. Yeah.
And I'm kind of annoyed with myself that I rented for so long during a period of stratospheric increases in the prices of property. And I would look at them going up and I think, well, this can't last. And I wait another year and I think, well, it's not going to last much more than this. And it just kept doing it. 10 years later, I completely priced myself out of the market.
Yeah.
All right, thanks for that, Neil. 0345 6060 973. So we're talking about buying as opposed to renting. The suggestion is that actually, if you've found yourself unable to buy, you might be the lucky one. The decision might have been made for you, but in the end, you might be the fortunate one because you you retain a sense of freedom. You can up sticks and go, whereas if you were tied down to a property with a mortgage, well, you're stuck there, really. Is that the way you see it? 0345 6060 973. York. Hello, Brian.
Oh, hi. Good evening, Nick. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I just thought I'd ring in. I found the conversation interesting. You mentioned earlier that somebody else texted in to tell you that Lloyds have been buying properties, and I think you presumed these were commercial properties.
Yeah.
They've actually launched a rental brand called Fit for Living, and they're targeting ownership of 10,000 homes by the end of 2025, 50,000 homes by the end of 2030.
And when you say ownership, you mean the bank owns, and then the bank rents out. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. They're looking to own thousands and thousands of homes across Britain. So basically what people have to understand is that they're competing now with very powerful and rich groups and individuals that are actually causing a massive increase in the price of assets across the board. It's not just houses. It's stock markets, it's gold, it's commodities, it's everything. And it's been going on for more than a decade, probably longer than that. But it's getting worse. And, you know, if these organizations are going to start swallowing up large portions of the housing market, then you're going to have less and less houses for sale that people can afford. And it's just going to get worse, I'm afraid. It's not going to get better. I was watching an interesting podcast today with the guy that was going to be running for Prime Minister a few years ago. I always forget his last name. Rory... oh, God, what's his last name? And the guy that used to be Blair's right-hand man. Oh, they do a podcast together.
Yes. I'm momentarily getting a blank myself. Rory...
Anyway,
what were they saying? Yeah. Alistair Campbell is the other chap.
I don't know if you've heard of a guy called Gary Stevenson.
He's the the ex-city trader.
That's him, yeah. And, you know, I mean, he puts this quite plainly, you know. He's got a really good YouTube channel, and he tries to put kind of like economic principles and the challenges that we're facing from the rise in asset prices that's kind of affecting normal people more and more and more. And they were making that point on the podcast today. But, I mean, it's not a new point, really.
It sounds like a yet more massive transfer of wealth from the from all of us lot, the little people, to to those that already have. I mean, if banks now are buying up vast numbers of properties in order to, hedge against whatever might happen in the future, because if they're in both ends of the market, if they're giving people mortgages or, you know, providing mortgages for people on the one hand to buy homes, mm-hmm. and also buying homes themselves to rent out, then that's a pretty secure place for a bank to be, I guess.
It is. And, you know, there's a lot of ethical questions here, isn't there?
Well, yes, always. when the finance industry is concerned, yes. It was Rory Stewart, by the way. Just come to me. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, you're correct. Yeah.
All right. Correct. Good to talk to you. Thanks a lot, Brian. 0345-6060-973. On the subject of housing, Ben in Bexley Heath says, oh no, I've read that one. He has two sons. One is owning a house at 25 and the other frittered his time away enjoying himself. Anna says, no, I read that one as well. Kirk in Croydon, let's try this one. Regarding the house market, there is a difference between an investment and a purchase for long-term security and an investment in buy-to-let or quick returns. Many of us want houses for our kids, regardless of whether we lose some money. Some have always wanted a home, and it's not about the money. Some people come from money, and a home for security isn't the same for them. I'm getting deja vu. I think I've read that one as well. Pressing on. Slough. Hello, Sarah.
Hi. My mum and dad used to run an estate agent in the 70s in Fulham. So, like, my mum still kind of got a delusioned idea about even, like, the price of a garage and how much you could get it for to convert it into a new build. And I'm like, seriously, like, you know, I think back in the day you got steals, okay, whereas now it's very hard. I bought a place cash in East London, and I found it out a fluke, and I had a private car park right near Shoreditch, and I'd never ever be able to find that again in the rest of my life. That was 8 years ago. But like, now it is interesting in terms of all these new rights and stuff for renters, because I was talking to a barrister, okay, and he said this to me, and I was like, okay, basically a lot of women, a lot of people don't leave domestic abuse scenarios because they don't want to leave their dog.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas now with renters, you can bring your dog and stuff. And like the thing is, I would hate to be stuck in a marriage where I'm like paying towards a big mortgage and stuff. Like when it comes to all this, and I don't know how much here as opposed to in America, like it differs, but it's very scary if you're going to get caught in a mortgage. I've never had a mortgage and I'm renting right now. But like just seeing about, let's say, for example, two of my mates that are app developers have just started renting a flat in Canary Wharf.
Oh, yeah.
And my friend was looking at the brochure for it, and it was a Chinese brochure, right? So obviously, like, loads of Chinese buyers have bought flats in this building. And you think, well, wow, is that, like, where half the new builds are going?
Yeah.
You know, and they get deals for going, like, X amount has to go to, like, social housing and so-and-so. But when I actually saw that, that was a real representation of, like, I've never seen a Chinese brochure for my mate renting in East London.
Yes, well, you know, as time goes by, the property developers do target different markets. I mean, for a while there, it was the Russians were buying everything, you know, particularly in ultra high value central London, Chelsea, places like that. And I can remember that towards the west of London, all of those tower blocks that were going up were bought before the first concrete had been poured by Malaysian wealth funds. So these are people with staggering amounts of money who buy entire buildings, and not necessarily as... It didn't seem that they were that particularly bothered about renting them out. They were just buying them as another asset. They were just, you know, diversifying their portfolios, just something that they thought was a solid investment that was never going to lose its value. And to the detriment, really, of everybody that lives in this country, because, first of all, they despoiled the horizon because they're all blooming ugly. And the second, we were being priced out of our own country.
And also, you know, you were saying you haven't really looked much into the Airbnb thing, but that is massive.
Hmm.
So, like, my best friend lives in Margate and every other building is Airbnb. Luckily, in her building, like, she lives in a well-known tower block, they've banned any, like, short letting,
right,
which is good, because otherwise she'd be definitely planning on having to leave because she'd make way more on just being able to invest in that and stuff. Mm. And that's a well-known problem all over London, everywhere, though. Yeah. So, okay, thanks, Nick.
Okay, thanks a lot, Sarah. Bye. And you, thanks a lot. 0345-6060-973. Greg says, I would 100% prefer to rent if it was to a council property, even if prices were higher than typical council homes today. I just don't want to be turfed out on the whim of a landlord with 2 months' notice. You know, the one country in Europe that does rent more than we do, and I was quite surprised when I found this out, that we have a lower level of property ownership in this country than almost any country in Europe. I definitely thought it was the other way around. I thought we were obsessed with owning properties in this country, but apparently not. Germany is the standout exception. Whereas 65% of us in the UK own our own homes, only 52% in Germany do. And the difference is in the rental market in Germany, or one of the reasons might be that the rental market in Germany is so much more controlled and so much more in favour of the tenant rather than the landlord. I mean, they have rent controls. For instance, that state that no new tenancy can be sold for more than 10% above local average prices. So no scalping, in other words. And they've also, as far as I'm aware, banned estate agent letting fees, which is something that has blighted people, you know, prospective tenants in this country for a good long while. So maybe we should be more German.
0345 6060 973. Do you think that buying your own home in this country now is not the route to freedom, but is actually a financial trap? You can text 84850, email nicka@lbc.co.uk. If you're on WhatsApp, it's the same number as the phone, 0345 6060 973.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
It was the moment the music stopped at a Taylor Swift dance class and three little girls were to lose their lives.
A man has been arrested following reports of a stabbing attack in Southport.
Now, chillingly, with tensions running high, could we be looking at a return of last summer's lawlessness? As for the politicians, is it again just words and warnings?
Southport must be a line in the sand.
Join me, Nick Ferrari, next week as we mark the Southport killings 1 year on.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on your radio, on Global Player and the new LBC app.
Feel the thunder of hooves, the tension as they race past. Your heart in your chest. That split second of silence. Before the roar of the finish. That glorious Goodwood feeling. Qatar Goodwood Festival, presented by Visit Qatar, July 29th to August 2nd. Book now.
Summer's here, and so is our big summer price drop. Book a Jet 2 holiday for this July and August and save up to £50 per person. That's up to £100 per couple. From the amazing Algarve to gorgeous Greece. With a choice of fantastic 4- and 5-star hotels still available. Don't miss out. Book now with Jet 2 holidays. Package holidays you can trust. Up to natural protected. Subject to availability and conditions.
Here comes Steve, with the satisfied smile of a man who's checking out at midday after a great night's sleep and a delicious unlimited brekkie. See the untamable bedhead hair, and if you look really close, you can see that properly well-rested glow, which can only mean one thing. Last night, he slept at Premier Inn. Get better sleep for your money. Premier Inn. Rest easy. Breakfast subject to availability. T's and C's apply.
For stunning retirement apartments to buy or rent, search McCarthy Stone or call 0800 153 3055.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
Yeah, we're talking about the idea that owning your own home is not a route to freedom. It is actually financial enslavement. I might be putting it a bit rich, but that's essentially the idea of the chap that I was talking to at the beginning of the hour, Josh Kirby. He's the senior money writer at The Telegraph, and he's insisted that he will never buy a home because he thinks that mortgages are a trap. Does that fit your worldview? Bristol. Hello, James.
Hi, mate. You're right.
Yes, good, thanks.
I own my own property, and, well, I have a mortgage, and I have done for the last 5 years, and I've loved it. I love owning my own place. I grew up bouncing between council houses or private lets. My mum was a single mum, so it was, you know, she always had it hard, and it was, she was always on benefits and trying to work as much as she could and pay for everything. And I just remember, you know, you could never have your room painted the colour you wanted, or you could never put a shelf up here or do this there. And when I was really lucky. I got into an industry and I worked really, really, really hard, and I saved every penny that I could. And I ended up delivering courses in the industry at the age of 22, and then managed to save enough money and have enough income to get a mortgage. And it just felt like freedom, and it felt like security.
Security, I get, but the freedom part is an interesting word, because it's really kind of the opposite of that, isn't it? It's not freedom at all. You are tied down to that home, and changing the place you live is very difficult.
I don't think so. I'm looking at selling my place next year and moving, getting something bigger, because I want to start a family. And I've spoken to estate agents, and I've spoken to the solicitor for it, and I don't think it doesn't feel overwhelming or hard in any particular way. buying it didn't feel overwhelming or hard in any particular way.
And you don't feel that owning a home, of course, every expense is down to you. But if, you know, if the boiler broke when you were renting, then that's not your problem. That's the landlord's problem.
No, but I pay far less to have my home. So it swings and roundabouts, isn't it? You pay that landlord X amount of money to cover the mortgage plus, you know, a bit extra, which would, I guess, be classed as profit, and you'd put some of it away, or you would pay an estate agent an amount of money to manage the property for you. But I think a lot of it's money responsibility. There's I find a lot of my generation and younger don't seem to have a lot of money responsibility. I don't know if we should be teaching it in schools more or what, but where I think I was brought up with not a lot, and I'm lucky enough now to have my own business, and I worked really, really hard for 3 years, and we're 5 years in now on track to turn over £1 million. So I'm not in a position where I need to worry anymore.
Right.
But
good for you.
You know, I started it with £1. Anyone can do it. You've just got to put your mind to it, and you've got to work hard.
Well, I'd my fingers in the air to register a complaint about that. Not everyone can do it. It's like saying, well, I won the lottery. Anyone can do it. All you got to do is buy a ticket. Well, yes, there's all sorts of things that come between people and success. And some people are very lucky, and some people aren't. And of course, working hard will increase your luck. And I wish you all the very best. Thanks a lot, James. Julie says, the rent is too high because benefits pay toward rents. If they couldn't afford it, rents would have to come down. And I am speaking as a landlord of a property. That's an interesting thought. But how would people survive, though, if they benefits did not go towards rent? Difficult to know how people would cope. Merton, Kasim.
Hello there. It's my first time calling into LBC. I've been listening
welcome
to you
along.
Since I was a kid in my mum's car. I'm calling in because I bought a house in London last year, so I was 27 at the time, so last October. And I think in the conversation, the key question is a mortgage a financial burden? And I think his name Josh Kirby or John Kirby, the guy from The Telegraph, very smart chap.
Yeah.
The argument from him seemed to be that, well, it's a financial commitment, a very large financial commitment, admittedly, and that makes it a financial burden. You're trapped, and there's an opportunity cost there. You know, do you pour money into paying off your mortgage, or do you invest in the stock market? But to me, that seems to miss sort of, that doesn't tell us half the story, right? Because if you want to compare apples and apples, if you take out a personal loan of a very large amount and pay that back, that's a financial burden. You take out a mortgage, it's effectively an asset-backed security, effectively. You take out the money, you buy an asset. Yes, that asset may appreciate, that asset may depreciate, but you take the same risk in the stock market, for example. So the idea that it's a financial burden simply because it's a financial commitment, to me, seems to just miss the entire point of what a mortgage exists to be, which is effectively a highly leveraged acquisition of an asset.
Yeah, I wonder if part of the point that he was making was that it's no ordinary type of asset, is it?
In what way? If
well, you, you can't live in a block of gold. You can't live in shares in a company.
But equally, his point was that we should stop treating these things like assets, right? So the starting point is, well, you have something to live in that may increase, that may decrease.
Mm.
If it increases, then congratulations, you made a great investment, effectively, because that's secondary to actually living somewhere. If it decreases, well, at the same time, congratulations, you've got somewhere to live. And yeah, you might end up in negative equity at the end of the day, but you weren't ever buying it as an investment in the first place.
I suppose so, but it's also a much more significant investment than most people would spend on, like, stocks and shares or, investment.
And I do take that point. I mean, for me, I had to save up, started work at 22, 23, so you had to save up for, 4 or 5 years. And I take that point, but sort of the scale of what you're spending on, it doesn't change the underlying point, which is you're getting something which has a use.
No, that is correct, but it is a more significant outlay than almost. I mean, if you're an expert as he is, then playing the stock market is something that you might feel comfortable with. I wouldn't. I don't know anything about it. But I've got a vague idea of housing. But even if I did know about the stock market, there's no way I would borrow the kind of money that I would have to buy a house to play the stock market. I mean, that would be, I wouldn't even consider it. And neither would most people. So I think it's the amount that you outlay and the consequent enormity of the downside that is unique to property.
What's the downside?
Well, the downside would be you bought at the top of the market and there was a corrective crash that, wiped a six-figure sum off your asset.
But that's a risk that exists in relation to anything.
Well, I know, but we're going around in a tight circle here, Kasim, but my point is that most people would not spend the kind of money on any other gamble that they would on a house, but I get your point. Thanks for that. I'll give you the last word. Appreciate your input in the next hour. Something else. Pharmacies are warning that the demand for weight loss medication will become unsustainable. 21% of people who were interviewed in a National Pharmacy Association Commission poll agreed that they had attempted to access weight loss treatments in the last year, either online or in person at a pharmacy, rising to 35% of 16 to 34-year-olds. Is this the future of weight loss? And should we be relying on these drugs to solve our obesity crisis? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight, the King and Prime Minister have congratulated the Lionesses, who for the second time running are European champions. Reaction at a fans gathering in Croydon after England retained their Women's European Championship title. They came from a goal down to draw 1-1 against Spain and then win 3-1 on penalties in Basel. Manager Serena Wiegmann says it's hard to take in what they've achieved.
Yeah, I was like, oh, how can this happen? But it happens. So, very happy. I'm so incredibly proud of the team and the staff. And yeah, we're just going to party tonight.
The US and EU have reached a trade deal after talks at Donald Trump's Turnberry Resort in Ayrshire. Both sides have agreed that goods coming into America will face 15% tariffs across the board. The US had threatened to impose 30% levies from August if no agreement could be made. Speaking beside the European Commission President, President Trump talked up the deal.
I think it's great that we made a deal today instead of playing games and maybe not making a deal at all. I think it's, I'm going to let you say, but I think it's the biggest deal ever made. Thank you very much.
Israel has begun daily pauses in fighting in three areas of Gaza to address the worsening humanitarian situation. It says there is no starvation in the territory. The charity MSF says Israel is deliberately asphyxiating Palestinians. The Prime Minister is expected to meet President Trump tomorrow in Scotland to discuss a longer-term ceasefire. The leader of the Conservative Party, Kemi Badenoch, is promising to ban doctors' strikes if her party returns to power. She says she'd change the law to stop widespread industrial action as a strike by resident doctors moves towards its fourth day out of five. Former adviser to Theresa May, Charlie Rowley, told LBC the medics have already had a generous deal.
The idea of doctors going on strike, having had a 22% pay increase at the last budget, where other public sector workers did get a pay rise also, but didn't get anywhere near that percentage increase, I think that's why people feel that this is just a step too far.
And three people have been arrested at a demonstration and counter-protest outside a hotel housing migrants in Essex. A dispersal order for part of Epping remains in force tonight. LBC weather. After a generally dry night, Monday will be a drier and brighter day with a gentle breeze. One or two light showers across England and Wales during the afternoon. Highs of 24. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Matt Hewitt.
The This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Pharmacies are warning of what they call an unsustainable surge in demand for weight loss medications, particularly those containing semaglutide or tirzepatide. Hope I've got that right. These are drugs like Ozempic and Mounjaro. Let's talk about this with Thorin Govind. Thorin is a former chair of the Royal Pharmaceutical Society in England and is a pharmacist and healthcare lawyer. Good evening, Thorin.
Good evening. Yes, we are seeing more and more interest in these medications. And actually, what we've also seen is advertising standards agency rapping, and this has included some influencers and celebrities, their testimonials about this sort of medication. And we know that we are not allowed to promote prescription-only medication. So it is interesting how we are seeing the rise of the popularity of GLP-1 medications like Wegovy, Ozempic, Mounjaro, as you've mentioned there.
So are we going to get to the point where people just won't be able to get it?
Well, already, you know, we are already having to think about the supply and manage that supply. As we know as well, there are drug companies doing trials for these similar sorts of drugs to these in a pill form, and we're going to be looking at that. But yeah, we do have to constantly be considering making sure that, so the actual core ingredient of these drugs, so if we look at Wegovy, the core ingredient is a drug called semaglutide. The Wegovy is like the brand name, which can be used for weight loss and is part of that reduced calorie diet and increased physical activity, that holistic approach. So we do have issues getting hold of some of these medications, and this has been, you know, influenced by the rise in popularity. What I would say, though, is this cohort who are eligible for this, on the NHS, it's a little bit more discreet than those who are completely allowed and licensed to be provided with this drug. We are constantly trying to obviously make sure that supply meets demand, but obviously that it's appropriate for that individual patient.
And is this potential shortfall just specific to this country, or is it a worldwide problem?
I think it's, you know, a worldwide problem in terms of these drugs have had a boom all over the globe. I was actually away last week and people were talking about this as well. So what we need to think about is making sure that the right people get them in the most appropriate way. So we also know that people are selling these illegally online, and people may be accessing them and not actually knowing what's in them. So it's very important that people only access them via regulated sources like your pharmacy.
Is this the kind of thing that people should be taking without medical supervision?
Absolutely not, and this is the main concern. So we know that people are accessing these medications via social media marketplaces, via black markets, etc. So we need to make sure, if you access these drugs via those other sources, there's absolutely no guarantee that you are getting the actual drug. You could be getting something that isn't actually the drug at all, for example.
Well, that's kind of frightening. If somebody is is taking this, though, and they find that they can't get any further supply from their, let's assume in the best circumstance, from their doctor, what's the consequence of taking it and then having to stop?
Okay. In the long term, we need to think about all the habits that are around this medication. So we know that they suppress the appetite. So it's important that you obviously try and maintain it. But if there is a time where you may have an impact on supply, it's about working with your healthcare professional in your particular circumstances to see if there's other mechanisms. It might be other mechanisms that you can work with them around to support you with your weight loss. Now, as I say, this is about a holistic approach. So this is one of a number of things that we need to think about. It's absolutely important that people are liaising regularly with their healthcare professional on this, because we may be thinking about tapering doses. So when I mean tapering, I mean thinking about tinkering with the dose that you're on as we see the benefit of treatment.
And the kind of people that are taking these things, buying it on the black market and so on, I'm guessing they're doing that because they don't fit the criteria for getting the drug on the NHS, which would be a certain BMI, the presence of other, I think they call them comorbidities, don't they?
Yes.
Other sort of illnesses and so on that might be helped by this drug. Are the people who are, you mentioned influence and so on, are they just the kind of person who wants to drop a couple of pounds for the beach?
I mean, we're seeing this a lot. I mean, I'm getting married soon, and we're seeing this in terms of people going, oh, I'm just going to get hold of this medication just in terms of before I get married. And I would really urge people to, this is a medication that you are putting into your body. Before you even start the process of this, we need to be thinking about the habits around food and exercise and lifestyle. I think what I'm also keen to think about is if people are offering this on the black market, often it can be what you think is the drug, but often at the same price point. So it's a complete scam. You don't know what you're getting. And that's why it's so important to speak to a regulated professional about this. And we know that criminals are constantly trying to impact the credible and very real supply chain. So it's very important that you work with your healthcare professional. And, we are on the alert as well to make sure what is coming to us is the credible drug.
And even if you are taking the real thing, it's not without consequences. What are the side effects that may come with it?
Well, again, absolutely. All drugs have side effects. And with these GLP-1 medications, there's a lot of nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation, those sorts of stomach issues are quite common. And they can be managed with your healthcare professional in some cases. That could be via changing the dose, the dose adjustment, working with your healthcare professional. It's really key that you stay hydrated. And again, that diet is so important. It's not just a case of taking an injection and carrying on with eating as usual. These need to be linked to those habits and looking at the food that you're eating as well.
Couldn't you skip the drug and just go straight to eating less?
I think we need to make sure people have that in mind, and I think they do. But we know that this drug has an impact in terms of you don't think about food as much. And I know it's this food noise that we're talking about more and more with these injections, these weight loss medications. So I understand. So absolutely, we all need to be thinking about what we're actually putting in our bodies. Is it nutritious? How are we moving our bodies? But I do think that for some people, that food noise can be very, very hard to get over. And sometimes for some people, this medication can help them start that, really give them a kick to get on that journey towards managing their weight.
And is that the reason why people find it so difficult to shed weight? Is because they're constantly, even if they don't want to think about food, their body is screaming at them about food.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot about that. I think also, with the fast world that we live in, it can be easy to access those higher calorie, maybe not so nutritious foods more cheaply. I think it's also just part of our lifestyles as well. Think about how maybe life used to gather around as a family and eat together, and there'd be a lot more time for socializing and the food that we were eating and things like that. And I think it's also modern life doesn't always support us to have those better food options, I would say.
Well, I mean, the kind of food that we eat now is significantly different to how it used to be many decades ago. I mean, 70s, even into the 80s, our diet has changed, and ultra-processed food is a big factor. Do you think that we're in a sort of tobacco industry moment? Should food companies pay for the harm they've caused, just as cigarette manufacturers did before?
I think that's a really interesting one. It'd be interesting to hear what the listeners think on that one. I think we've been through such a move with this, haven't we? You know, someone might say, yeah, perhaps we should have more warnings similar to you know, cigarette packaging as to the impacts of obesity can have on the body. I think people are aware of the impact of obesity. It has such a widespread impact on the whole body, all of our organs. And I think that's such a difficult question. And there will also be some of the listeners thinking about, you know, where is my personal choice end up on this? And that's another big debate in this area as well when it comes to weight loss jabs and medication, because we know that a huge number of people are accessing them privately because they cannot access them through the NHS, or they can't access them quick enough on the NHS. So I don't know about that one, Nick, to be honest, but I think we're definitely having a moment here where we're thinking about what we're putting in our bodies more than ever. And even alcohol, we know that people are drinking less than they used to do.
Well, let's talk about the money. It costs about £150 a month, something like that, to be on these drugs. And the NHS is, as far as I'm aware, taking 200,000 patients expected to be prescribed this drug. That's £30 million a month, £360 million a year. Will the NHS get back the money that it's spending by saving on other medical interventions that they would have had to do with the people that if they hadn't have lost the weight?
Well, I think that's a key question, isn't it? And when it comes to NHS spending on obesity, like I say, it doesn't just impact the whole, it impacts the whole body. So obesity is costing the NHS about $6 billion a year. That's going to be going up. Obesity is, you know, going up. We've also got wider societal costs that we need to think about. If you think about productivity, social care, economic inactivity, obesity is one of the second biggest preventable causes of cancer in the UK. It contributes to heart disease, diabetes. It's the financial burden affects not just healthcare, but economic growth.
And that 200,000 patients is just a start, because the government says in the next 10 years, 1.6 million people could be prescribed this drug, which works out to about £3 billion a year, or the cost of two new medium-sized hospitals. Are we going to get to the point where we just flat out can't afford this?
I am interested to see how these costs are going to work going forward. I think we also need to think about the people who are going to be delivering this care. And obviously we've heard quite a lot about junior doctor strikes, etc. And we also need to think about the workforce, because actually it's not just about prescribing in this case. If we're really going to provide proper care, we need to be thinking about the dietitians, the psychologists, the physical activity coaches, which wrap around with this care, because it's not as simple as just a jab or a medication. So I think going forward, they've got this keen to roll this out further. I'm going to be keen to see how this delivery actually comes out in fruition, really.
And do you think that with all the coverage in the press and so on, that people actually get that this, it's not a magic cure, that they have to actually put in some effort themselves?
This has been my concern for a little while now, in terms of making sure that people are aware that it isn't just about the weight loss, the actual medication. And I am trying to encourage people to think about integrative health. So when you are prescribed a medication, there are things that you can do with your lifestyle to support that medication to work better, or might impact how much you need that medication in some cases. So what I'm really keen going forward is for people to think about, you know, their exercise. How are we getting in the gym? Even, you know, for young women these days, we've seen the narrative change about weight loss and weightlifting, for example. You know, weightlifting used to be seen as maybe for the preserve of men. We don't want to get bulky as women. And we're seeing that narrative change. So I want the narrative to change, I think, around food and some of these weight loss medications as well. I don't think we should be stigmatising those who take them either.
And just finally, these are all relatively new drugs, aren't they? How confident
are physicians about the long-term effects?
Absolutely, and we are always monitoring new drugs as they come on the market. As healthcare professionals, we've got to report any side effects or any concerns that we have about these medications. They are doing more and more trials as we carry on. And as I say, they are looking into different forms because we know that injections are not tolerable to everybody. So I think, you know, we are looking at how these drugs impact the body going forward, and there are studies going on. But as with any drug, every drug has risk versus benefit, and it must be considered for that individual.
Very good to talk to you, Thorin. Thanks so much for your time. That's Thorin Govind, pharmacist, healthcare lawyer, and former chair of the Royal Pharmaceutical Society in England. So these things have been sort of marketed as a magic salve, a no-effort way to lose weight. And I wonder if you have any experience of using these. Have you taken any of these weight loss drugs? Did you get it from your GP, or did you have to go online, or did you just find that when you asked, they wouldn't give it to you for one reason or another? I mean, cost is one of them. Do you think that we should be spending what is going to be about £3 billion a year, that is £3,000 million a year, on helping people lose weight? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
LBC.
Here comes Steve, with the satisfied smile of a man who's checking out at midday after a great night's sleep and a delicious unlimited brekkie. See the untamable bedhead hair, and if you look really close, you can see that properly well-rested glow, which can only mean one thing. Last night, he slept at Premier Inn. Get better sleep for your money. Premier Inn. Rest easy. Breakfast subject to availability. T's and C's apply.
The people of Britain have bought loads of noise-cancelling headphones. With a Barclaycard Rewards credit card, you could get cash back on eligible purchases and no fees on spending overseas. What you buy is your business. Rewarding you is ours. Subject to financial status, T's and C's apply. Check if you're eligible at barclaycard.co.uk. Representative example, 28.9% APR representative variable and 28.9% purchase rate per annum based on a £1,200 credit limit.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So we're talking about weight loss drugs, and there is a booming demand for these weight loss jabs, and the demand may become unsustainable, some pharmacists are warning. Many more patients are interested in losing weight by using these jabs than are actually suitable for the treatment. That is according to the National Pharmacy Association, which represents more than 6,000 independent community pharmacies. And I wonder if perhaps it's the influence of the media, which is forever portraying people that we know, you know, stars, have lost an enormous amount of weight, and they're putting it down to these jabs, which makes you think, well, why can't I have that too? If a star who has lost a bit of weight and they didn't seem particularly overweight beforehand, and now they're showing off their slender physique in the pages of the right wing press, actually that's not fair. Not necessarily just the right wing press, but it tends to be. Most press in this country does tend to be right wing. Are we being influenced to think that something that we should be able to deal with a bit of self-control, is something to be medicalized? 0345 6060 973. Fife. Hello, Alex.
Hello there.
Alex.
I'm just following up to say that I started taking the Manjaro a few months ago. Just before that, I had to go for blood tests, which was normal. Then I started taking Manjaro. And then 6 weeks later, I had to go for more blood tests, and it found that Manjaro had actually affected my kidneys, and I had to stop taking it.
And so presumably you were taking it on the NHS?
No, I done it online.
Right. So why online? So you bought it from a private supplier?
Yes, I did do some research. I got a proper pharmacist and ordered it online. Yes.
And what propelled you to get a blood test then?
I get a blood test every year, an annual blood test, because we've been mobile abuse. So I had that blood test 2 days or 3 days before I started Mounjaro.
Yes.
And when I went back to get the test results, the doctor says, I just need to get another blood test done because I want to check something out. And it wasn't that which I found fault with. It was something completely different, which he said was caused by the Mounjaro injection itself.
Huh. That's obviously extremely serious, and you should. Yeah. It sounds like you should stop taking it. But what was your experience?
I've stopped taking it, yeah.
Right, but what was your experience other than that of taking that drug?
Taking the drug itself. When I took it on a Saturday, I was guaranteed I was ill either the Sunday or the Monday. Nausea, just feeling absolute rough. But it only lasted a day. And within that 6 weeks, I actually lost 2.5 stone.
Wow.
So it was working well for me. But as I said, I'm not prepared to ruin my kidneys.
No.
For this. Do you know what I mean?
That is an extraordinary drop in weight. How did that feel?
It felt great because I have arthritis in my knees and I was feeling the benefits of it. I wasn't caring about the day of being ill. That didn't bother me, but it was a great feeling that I was losing this weight. And when you talk about food noise, I do suffer from that, and that had all gone. And I was only having like 3 meals a day, and it was a normal sized portion for me. You know what I mean? So it was working.
And have you tried any kind of weight loss or weight management in the past?
I don't know.
And so
it just didn't work.
It didn't work, right.
No.
Well, it does seem like, apart from, in your case, the very serious side effects, it does seem like some sort of magic potion, doesn't it? Because if it can switch off the desire to have food...
Exactly.
Then that is really the major obstacle in front of people actually succeeding in dropping weight. This sort of constant thing with your mind is just churning over about food all the time. People obsess about food, and they do calorie counting. And what that means is that it's always on your mind, which makes eating less of it extremely difficult.
But I'll just say that once I stopped taking the Mounjaro, it didn't take long before that to come back again.
Right.
So, and I'll be honest, all the weight that I lost, I practically all put it all back on again because it was back to square one.
Does that mean that if you had taken it and it hadn't affected your liver, then...
Kidneys.
Kidneys.
Yeah.
Then you would have had to take it forever.
I think it worked that way. I think what they do is that they see that they wean you off you. So to understand, you start off at a low dosage, like it's like it's 5 milligrams or something, and then you go up to 7.5, then up to 10 after 4 weeks, every 4 weeks. And then after you've reached your goal, you go back down the scale again.
Mm.
And start to wean yourself off it. But I think it's a case of once you stop taking it, you've got everything's going to go back.
Right.
You know, it's like a painkiller. You take a painkiller and it dulls the pain. Stop taking the painkillers and the pain comes back.
The pain comes back. Yeah.
This is not an easy, it's not an easy fix. And, you know, it's I don't know, it's just a fad, I think, to be honest. And I, when people realise that, I read the paper here that some like 5 people have died in the past few months taking this drug.
Really? I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah, it just shows you it's not a case of injection and everything's going to be fine.
Mm.
There's serious things attached to it that people are not clicking to because all they want to lose is a couple of pounds, you know what I mean?
Well, it was very fortunate, I guess, that you had that blood test scheduled and you managed to stop it, hopefully, in time. Yeah.
And it was very, very good of the doctor actually noticing it as well.
Yes.
I mean, I've had my kidneys and all that checked out now. But there's still an ongoing problem with it.
Right. Well, I wish you all the best. Yes. Well, I wish you all the best, Alex, and thanks for the call.
Kevin in Notting Hill says, regarding obesity and whether food companies should pay for the harms of ultra-processed food, I think they should, yes. And so should alcohol companies pay for the harms of alcohol to society. I seem to recall a fast food chain and separately a coffee shop company being charged to clean up their litter under extended producer responsibility schemes. Just as the litter is an unwanted consequence of the financial success of these companies, unwanted health consequences is also an unwanted consequence, I'd hope, says Kevin. Yeah, I mean, I've been saying for the longest time that I think that the human race is being poisoned because we've changed shape, and there's no doubt that that's true. Just look at any picture of a crowd in the 1970s and compare and contrast to a picture of a crowd today, and you'll see that our entire race has changed shape. And it's the food companies that have done it. Hove, hello, Graham.
Hey, Nick, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, I was just listening to you, the last caller, and I thought I'd call in and give you an idea of... I had a very unpleasant picture of me taking it on New Year's Eve and decided I need to do something about my weight. I was 15 stone. I'd put on like 2.5 stone. So I went on the website, Newman website, and got Mounjaro, and I took it for 2 months.
Yeah.
And it completely, 100% sorted me out.
Are you still taking it?
No.
I've
actually lost another over half a stone after not taking it. It just reset. It basically reset me completely. Like all the food noise. I went back to the way I was before I put the weight on.
So it changed. You know, it didn't just make you eat less. It actually changed your relationship with food.
It just rebalanced my relationship with food.
Right.
It rebalanced it. Weirdly enough, it even stopped me wanting to have a drink, which is kind of an added bonus.
Mm.
It hasn't gone back, and I've continued to lose weight, and I've got back into my old habits of exercise. I mean, basically, if you don't, you know, it's not going to work if you just take it and think that you can carry on.
Right, with your old lifestyle.
And it's been a complete life changer. My blood pressure's down. I'm running again. You know, I used to run all the time. I'd stop running. I'm back doing that like 3 or 4 days a week.
Hmm.
The weight hasn't gone back on, and so it just stopped. It stopped me thinking about it, food right. all the time,
yeah.
And it's been really amazing, actually.
Well, I mean, that's a positive note to end on. Appreciate that, Graham. Thanks for that. We're going to take a break for the news, after which we'll get a weather update from the founder and senior consultant at British Weather Services, Jim Dale, about the unprecedented weather across Europe and what we can expect here in the next couple of weeks. It's just past 12:30 on LBC. The news headlines with Matt Hewitt.
The King and Prime Minister have congratulated the Lionesses, who, for the second time running, are European champions. England retained their Women's European Championship title, coming from a goal down to draw 1-1 against Spain and then win 3-1 on penalties in Basel. The EU says a trade deal with Donald Trump's America will provide certainty in uncertain times for citizens and businesses. The US will charge a 15% tariff on imported EU products in what Mr. Trump's hailed the biggest deal ever made. And Israel has begun daily pauses in fighting in 3 areas of Gaza to address the worsening humanitarian situation. It says there is no starvation there. Save the Children says an Israeli government siege is starving the people of the territory. LBC weather, after a generally dry night, Monday will be a drier and brighter day with a gentle breeze and highs of 24.
LBC.
Vodafone's new customer service is a little bit different. It's called Just Ask Once. Message them on the Vodafone app. You deal with one person and they keep you updated until it's sorted, so you can get on with your day. Walk his ears then. Just Ask Once. Customer service made easy from Vodafone, the nation's network.
Available via your My Vodafone app. Messaging service only. Exclusions apply. Vodafone UK supporting the nation since 1984. More details at vodafone.co.uk/network.
The longer days are here. And you know what that means? It's time for the Halfords Big Summer Sale. Grab up to 50% off a great range of motoring and cycling essentials for the holidays, like car cleaning, bikes, scooters and dash cams. So whether you're hitting the road, the bike trails or your favourite camping spot, you'll find plenty of savings to suit you. Visit your local Halfords experts in-store or shop online. Offer subject to availability, full T's and C's and exclusions apply. See halfords.com for details.
Leading Britain's conversation, Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Turkey and other parts of the Balkan Peninsula have been gripped by a heatwave this week. In Greece, it was so hot that authorities closed the Acropolis. Rainfall in the area has been about 90% below average this year, leading to widespread wildfires. Meanwhile, in northern Scandinavia, they've been experiencing intense heat, with maximum temperatures at least 10 degrees centigrade above what they're used to for this time of year. In the North Pacific, sea surface temperatures have been 5 degrees centigrade higher than average, threatening the most important regions for fishery stock replenishment in the world. Typhoon Wiffa continued to wreak widespread damage across Asia, and a series of freak storms have struck popular Spanish tourist hotspots, turning roads into raging rivers, and hail has been so large to have smashed car windows. Let's talk about this with Jim Dale, who joins us on the phone now. Jim is founder and senior consultant at British Weather Services. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Nick.
It's all happening elsewhere, but not so much here.
It is. Yeah, it's... I hasten to say it's been a bit of a pedestrian week for me in the UK, as in looking at UK weather, because obviously we've come out of our heat wave, we've come out of, well, not quite out of the drought, but we, you know, we've had a bit of rain around. You might say it's bog standard ordinary. Whether people prefer the ordinary to what we had previously, you know, that's for each individual to decide upon. But yeah, it's this side of the equation, this side. I mean, it basically shows that it's not everywhere all at once. That's not the way the weather or climate change works. It will always affect one part of the world or a couple of parts, and somewhere else will just go into the norm, if you like. And that's essentially what we're seeing at this moment in time. So you've mentioned all of these places around the world, some of them exotic, some of them not, and that's where the big stuff is happening at this moment in time. So for us, and even going forward this week, it's a little bit, dare I say it, boring. for me anyway, in terms of saying, okay, what am I going to put? I tell you what, I put a 1 to 10 day forecast out this morning, and on the warnings I just put nothing, zero, nil, something. In other words, nothing going on. I'm just waiting for something to come along. But look, that's where we find ourselves at the moment. But other parts of the world, as you've mentioned, absolutely not.
Yeah. Now you mentioned rain. Now to my mind, we've had barely any of it at all this year. A little bit lately. Has that been enough to replenish aquifers and reservoirs and so on?
Absolutely not. Yeah, there's been one or two spots that have seen something that you could say is reasonable. West of Scotland, particularly, a bit of Northern Ireland from time to time. Look, I think on the whole, it's probably been welcomed, even if it's only been a bit. But I've got a rain gauge outside this office here, and even in the last 2 weeks, it's hardly filled. It's about 8 millimetres in total. That's not enough to do anything and make any difference at all to hose pipe bans, to drought regions in the UK. So, no, we sit and wait, and, that's about where we are, so the deficit continues.
If it doesn't rain significantly this winter, we're in trouble, aren't we?
Yeah, we started the trouble back in spring, of course we did. But if we... Okay, so what I'm going to mention something here, because it's called the other side of the coin. I'm a big believer, irrespective of climate change, but Mother Nature in terms of trying to, like physics does, if we go back to our school days, physics tries to balance things out. That's what it does. And I think over the long term, although you get stuck in these ruts from time to time, and we're kind of in a little bit of a rut now, which for some is quite nice because it's cool, it's everything it probably wants to be. these things do swing around. So the drought turning into a flood and lots of rain go the, come the autumn, come the winter time, is far more probable than the opposite as going continuous drought. Why do I say that? Well, certainly in terms of climate change, the recipe for that on the can basically says that we get hot, dry summers, drought summers to a large degree, and springs, and the autumn and winter change it around and we get the floods. So my expectation would be that Mother Nature will deliver in one form or another. Watch out, watch your backsides on this one, some treacherous torrential type rain as we go through autumn into the winter period. Watch that space.
So we are two-thirds of the way through summer, and
yeah.
If we ignore the climate change aspect of it, it's been pretty good. You know, people are talking about it being sort of up there with the summer that people of a certain age always dream wistfully about.
1976.
Quite right. Yeah. How does it compare with that?
I think it compares extremely well. If you're a drought fan, if you're a heat fan, there is no doubt about it. I mean, the figures will be minced around as we come to the end of the summer. That the end of the meteorological summer, by the way, is the end of August. So yeah, once we get into September, although I call September the new summer month because we continue to get the last few Septembers have just been a continuation of summer anyway for the most part. But I think the numbers will be crunched then. I actually think some of what's gone on in terms of temperature profile, certainly sunshine totals, will far exceed what happened in 76. 76 tended to be a couple of 3 weeks, essentially. It got really bad. I think the spring wasn't so clever either in terms of delivering rainfall. So, again, it was added to. But I think this supersedes it for sure. So... not just here, but let's not just look at our own little island and say this is it, this is where it all happens or doesn't happen. We've got to look at these places that you mentioned. I'm going to add a couple to them, actually. Tampa Bay, yesterday, 100 degrees F, their record, top record temperature ever. It's right on the margin, so it may yet be cancelled, but it's give or take, it's right at it.
That's a pretty unbearable temperature in Tampa. It's very sort of humid there, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I've been there as well, and yeah, down in Florida, it tends to be that. It's very tropical, so that would have a big heat index attached to it. So the under degrees F, 38 degrees C, would feel a lot hotter than that. But you know, even in places like Kosovo, 42.4 yesterday, a new record. China, 50.4 yesterday. All-time record.
50.4.
Yeah,
wow.
Exactly. Japan and the Koreas, both north and south, all-time records, basically falling virtually every day. Not in one place necessarily, but here or there. You know, you pick your city, your town, your village, and that's where they're going. In fact, in Southeast Asia, get this one, records have been broken in Southeast Asia. This is heat records. Every single day, somewhere, Southeast Asia is a big, big area, of course it is, for the last 850 days.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to join dots, then there's a lot there, and that will tell you a picture about climate change. And, you know, you can go on there, and it's not just the heat as well. Major flooding in Beijing, northern China area, a few people have been killed there. And it just goes on and on. 30 degrees in the Arctic Circle, Norway, you mentioned it.
Really? Let me ask you about this, because I've wondered about this. How do meteorologists get from the actual temperature to the feels-like temperature?
Yeah, there's an equation. I'm not going to necessarily describe it across the radio, but there is an equation. To make it simple, the greater the humidity value... the greater the heat index moves upwards. So something that would be 30 degrees might actually feel like 40 degrees because of the humidity. Now, the humidity, the content of water in the air, in other words, you can't sweat that out because essentially your sweat's going nowhere, so you feel hotter because of it, hence the reason for the heat index. But anything approaching 80 degrees relative humidity would start to sort of instigate problems, deep problems. You often get this in I've just mentioned Southeast Asia. You often get it in those sort of places, Florida as well. The heat index catapults, etc. You just can't get rid of your sweat.
So is it only humidity? Because I've noticed on some days the humidity is lower than on the previous day, and the temperatures are the same, and yet the feels like temperature is hotter on the day with lower humidity. Or am I?
That might be. Yeah, you might be right with that. It's probably It is always more to do with the humidity and temperature than it is necessarily with wind direction, etc. Because right. The wind can cool you down, or it can, if it comes from the wrong direction, it can increase the heat, the yes. feel. You know, in other words, the fan doesn't blow cold; it right. blows hot.
I got it.
And that's when you get the other side of the equation. So.
Okay, right. As far as you can tell, what's August going to be like?
Okay. So, are we talking the UK here?
Oh yes.
Yeah. All right. Because it's hurricane season, of course, and we haven't seen much of those so far. There's been a few typhoons, and maybe we'll get one across to the UK at some point later. Remember what I said about the rainfall side of things. I would expect that will be the case at some point. I kind of think we'll stay with this for a couple of weeks now. So the first week of August does not look like heat wave weather. I think we'll get a 30 degree at some point in the middle of next week, but that will come away again. I think we're looking then to see whether there's going to be a switch change. The other side of the coin comes in second half of August, and we perhaps go back to the heat again. That's more likely than not, based on where we are at the moment and what we've just had for the last fortnight. So everything to play for. But I think we just, as ever, Nick, we've got to look wider and see what's going on, because I think there'll be other, I'm going to put more records, more tragedies, unfortunately, across the world for different reasons. So let's keep watching the space and keep chatting about it.
Very good to talk to you, Jim. As always, thanks for that. Jim Dale, founder and senior consultant at British Weather Services. Now, a short break and then off to America to talk to our political correspondent from there, John Christopher Buer.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Richard Spur.
As more details emerge of Jeremy Corbyn's new left-wing alternative to Labour, does Keir Starmer need to move away from the right to win back your support and to save his party from defeat?
Richard Spur on LBC.
Here comes Steve, with the satisfied smile of a man who's checking out at midday after a great night's sleep and a delicious unlimited brekkie. See the untamable bedhead hair, and if you look really close, you can see that properly well-rested glow, which can only mean one thing. Last night he slept at Premier Inn. Get better sleep for your money. Premier Inn. Rest easy. Breakfast subject to availability. T's and C's apply.
This is a paid-for advertisement by the British Airways American Express credit card. Everyday spending doesn't have to push back your next holiday, because card members collect one Avios for every eligible £1 spent with the BA Amex credit card, meaning there's a little holiday in the things you buy. Search BA Amex to apply for a British Airways American Express credit card. Representative 29.7% APR variable. No annual fee. Terms apply 18+. Subject to approval.
Us kids are mesmerised by the mundane, entranced by the everyday. Where grown-ups see a snail, we see a slippery-shelled beast from the undergrowth. But around 1 in 5 young children have a sight condition that can get in the way of all that wonder. The good news is, if these are found early, they can be managed or corrected. So book your child an eye test at Specsavers today. Find out more at specsavers.co.uk/kidstests.
40 million people listen to commercial radio each week. That's 80 million ears, give or take. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Off to America. Let's talk to John Christopher Buer, the White House correspondent for Real Political News. Hello, John.
Nick, it's a pleasure talking with you. It was very hot again today. I heard you talking about the heat. We've had 2 days where it was 50 degrees, ooh, and that's centigrade here.
Ow, yeah. 50? That's terrible. And it's not a dry heat where you are.
No, not at all. It's not the Sinai Desert. It's humid. One of the only more humid places in America is around the Gulf, like New Orleans or Houston. You know, that's Corpus Christi. Anything on the Gulf, but we get some nasty, nasty humidity.
Yeah, I think the only thing that's more humid is Donald Trump's golfing attire.
Well, his attire is one thing, I must say, but some clever bunch of folks, I don't know who they were following him, caught his caddy dropping the ball closer to the pin on the green.
Yes.
Which I thought was, my goodness, I mean, that's outrageous.
Yes. Yeah, he exited his bomb-proof golf cart to show the Scots how to cheat at their own game. Yeah,
You know, I love the Scots. You know, I love the Welsh. I love the English. I love the Irish, of course. My granny's from, people are from Dumfries and from Cork. You know, one of the protesters' sign said about Trump's mother should have black affront from him. Now, I'm not a Scotsman, but I hear that's quite a tag on Donald from his mom.
I'm not sure I understand that, but let's just
black affront seems to be a Scottish phrase, which means pretty bad.
Right. Well, I grew up in Scotland. I don't recognise that phrase, but I'll have to look up that sign later.
It basically means an embarrassment, but we all know what
right.
that means.
Okay. So he's touting what he's describing as the biggest trade deal that anybody ever made, believe me. And this is with the EU. And the upshot is that both the EU and America are in a worse position than they were before.
Well, exactly. This is what he did. He's looking for an off-ramp from the tariff mess that he's created. As with the Epstein and with his tariffs and with everything else, he creates this enormous problem, and then he goes about trying to solve it, and then he says, "Look, I solved the problem," which he created himself. I mean, the tariffs issue was about 4.8, I think, before he raised it to 27 or something outrageous, and then he raised the UK's, and then he had Starmer come here back in the springtime, and I guess he got sort of friendly with him. He invited him to see His Majesty, which is going to be interesting if the Brits still want him to come over. And the UK is at 10.
10, yeah.
Now.
Which
now
is,
it's at 10.
Which is 10 worse than it used to be.
Well, it is. But, you know, when you compare it to 500,000, you know, he's going to have this third party tariff of 500% tariffs. And the EU is at 15. So it's all numbers game with Mr. Deal. The art of the deal, you know what I mean.
Yeah, he said he was going to have 90 deals in 90 days, and so far he's got 2.5, because he was touting this supposed deal with Japan, and he was saying that Japan have agreed to this and have agreed to that, and Japan were saying, no, no, none of that is true. Yeah.
Well, he'll just go on and say whatever he thinks he wants to say. And his MAGA people will believe him. Japan, there's a deal sort of there. The UK, and then this EU thing, which, you know, he can tout it all he wants. Let's see what happens. Let's read the fine print, shall we?
Yeah. None of these prices, because, of course, everybody on earth, apart from Donald Trump and the people that surround him, know that a tariff is not paid by the country that is exporting the goods. It's paid by the country that's importing them. So all of
it's
these...
paid by the consumer, you're right.
All of these supposed deals, these tremendous deals for the American consumer, are actually making everything... And it hasn't sort of gone through yet because people have stock inventory to sell through before the new things that they bought from Japan or China or the EU, wherever, have come through. So the price rises haven't come through to the American consumer yet, have they?
Well, wait till it's time for Christmas shopping.
Yeah.
And wait till it's time for new school season to start. And, let's see what happens when the pain starts to set in. Because he hasn't really allowed for that, and he'll just keep going on, and his MAGA base will buy anything so far, but we'll see. Because there was unfortunately, the world must deal with Trump because the U.S. is a market of 350 million people. That's why, unfortunately, the world has to deal with us We have plenty of dough so far, and we buy stuff. So they're going to have to deal with us. So that's why we saw the commissioner from the EU, Ursula von der Leyen, dealing with him today in Turnberry. I believe that's where they went. And he's going to be with Starmer tomorrow. So yeah, we'll see.
Well, they've got to treat him like a grown-up, even if he doesn't behave like one. I thought it was fascinating. Go on.
I personally apologize for this.
I don't think we could hold you responsible, John, but we appreciate...
Well, somehow I feel guilty. Maybe it's my Irish Catholic
right.
background
well,
or something, but
we
I'm not going to...
We appreciate your apology. He said, Donald Trump said that in one of the promises that he made, that he was going to drive down drug prices by numbers that are not even thought to be achievable, among which are he's going to drive the prices down by 1,500%.
I don't know what drugs he's on, but I'll tell you that. There's some drug prices. And, you know, a lot of our pharmaceuticals are manufactured in Denmark and in Norway. Mm. And these pharmaceuticals are they're not included in the tariffs, by the way, just so you know.
Right, so that's a separate... Is that separate...
Yes.
Or they're just tariff free.
Well, they're not on the same tariff guidelines. Let's put it that way.
Right. You know, you say that this MAGA base is going to buy anything, but his approval rating for the handling of the Epstein files is at 16%. 16%.
Well, it's starting to fall into place now. They're looking at the Epstein issue. They're looking at who said what and what list is on and who's on what list. And they're realizing, wait a second, this is another thing, possibly, that Donald brought up to make himself look good, to separate himself from Epstein, who died in his cell, God knows how. And then he's going to try to distance himself and say, I have nothing to do with it. And then he's got Ghislain, as I like to say her name, Maxwell, who is in prison. And she's speaking to the number two head of the Justice Department, who came and spent 2 days with her in her cell in Florida, in her prison. Well, she came to a neutral space. And then that doesn't look like favoritism. And then Trump is going to have to decide whether or not to pardon her or to commute her sentence. I mean, what is this all about? If she says, well, Donald did nothing wrong. Donald was great. The DOJ... And the courts will decide. Trump knows he is in the files. He knows he is in the files. And this is going to come out. And Ghislain, I like to say the name, French, she's basically holding the ball right here.
Well, that is what people are expecting, that the upshot of this. And, of course, the person that's from the Justice Department is Donald Trump's ex-personal lawyer. Who is talking
to
this woman?
You remember that? How do you know about that? What do you know?
And so people are expecting that Ghislain, as I'll pronounce it, is going to spill the beans on a lot of radical left lunatics, as Trump would say, and mention him not at all, and by some magic process be pardoned.
Well, if Trump pardons her, the MAGA base will say enough is enough. And I'm just watching now on TV here, England beats Spain.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah, thanks. You're multitasking. You're watching the sport as well as we're speaking.
Well, you know, the soccer players are such charming young ladies. I have to say, my wife just gave me an elbow, but that's okay.
There's going to be a bipartisan resolution likely to pass to force the Attorney General, Pam Bondi, to release all of the unclassified material relating to Jeffrey Epstein. Now, does that mean
that
they'll just classify all the material relating to Jeffrey Epstein?
Yes, that means that they're going to have to do that. And then that will have to be released.
No, but
we still have three. Yes.
But if that happens, will the Justice Department and Trump's people just simply classify all the material that would be released by this resolution?
Well, that's a tricky question. But I'll tell you, Congress is in recession now, and they're home, and they're hearing it. they're getting hit too, from their constituents, and they're saying, release the names. We want to know the truth here. What is going on, guys? You're supposed to be in charge of things, and they're walking all over you, and we have a real crisis in this country because people don't know what to believe.
And to mark the scorecard, the things that Donald Trump promised, he promised the price of groceries to go down. Where have they gone?
Well, the prices have gone down on some levels, but like you said, there's inventory. We don't really know. I know the gas prices have not gone down, as Trump has said.
Right.
And that's an out-and-out falsehood.
Yeah, he says they're $1.99. Yeah, sorry to interrupt, but he said they're $1.99 a gallon, and there's no state in America that's selling it even close to that.
Hey, if you can get me that, I'll drive there to fill my tank. I don't care if it's in Ottawa.
Always good to talk to you, John. Thanks for that. John Christopher
Always.
Buer.
Such a pleasure.
White House correspondent for Real Political News. Thanks for your input this evening. We are at the end of our time tonight. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on Catch Up on Global Player and the new LBC app, where you can read and watch the latest from LBC. You can put your news categories in the order you want. You can pause and rewind live radio and listen to a range of podcasts. If you don't have it, it's free. Get the new official LBC app from your app store now. I'll be back Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Coming up at 4, it's Ian Payne. But first, Richard Spur.
Morning. Still to come, Bible sales in the UK have doubled and the number of young Brits attending church has quadrupled in 6 years. I'll be asking how important your faith is to you and whether you've gained, lost or changed your religious beliefs for some reason. But first, Jeremy Corbyn's new political party may now be called Your Party and has already signed up nearly 500,000 people. At the same time, Keir Starmer's support continues to wallow in the doldrums, with some of his closest aides urging him to change his political direction for the sake of his party and his premiership. So this morning, how do you believe the Prime Minister's policies need to alter to take him out of this nosedive? Does Labour now have to move more to the left to win back your support and survive the next election? When you call 0345 6060 973.
On your radio, on the LBC app and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, England have done it again.
It's going home. It's going. Football's coming.
Fans in Switzerland soaking it up. The Lionesses are, for the second time running, champions of Europe after beating World Cup winners Spain in the final in Basel. Extra time ended 1-1, sending them to penalties, with Chloe Kelly's hop, skip and a jump sealing the deal. This Lionesses supporter at a fan park in Wembley says she was the right woman for the job.
I knew she'd do it. I knew she'd do it. You just knew when it was her penalty, you were like, yes, that's the person that needs to hold that penalty. And she smashed it.
The King and Prime Minister are leading the messages of congratulation. There'll be a victory parade on Tuesday. A trade deal has been agreed between the US and the EU. Donald Trump agreed the deal with the European Commission leader at his Ayrshire golf course. He says it'll be great for cars as well as having a big impact on agriculture. Our Scotland political editor Gina Davidson has been watching negotiations.
A lot of hours have gone into thrashing out this deal, which will basically put 15% tariffs on most imports and exports going in and out of the US and the EU bloc. Ursula von der Leyen saying before they went into those talks that fairness had to be at the heart of what they decided, and that appears to be the case as they have come out.
Downing Street says the need to end the unspeakable suffering in Gaza will be high on the agenda for talks between Donald Trump and Sir Keir Starmer due later today. Israel has begun daily pauses in fighting in 3 areas of Gaza to address the worsening humanitarian situation. Pharmacists say a booming demand for weight loss injections like Wegovy and Mounjaro is fast becoming unsustainable. There's been a surge in the number of people trying to access the jabs, despite many not being clinically eligible. The National Pharmacy Association says social media's fueling demand, creating a rise in unregulated sales online. and a train crash that killed three people in southern Germany is under investigation. Two carriages came off the rails in a wooded area near the town of Riedlingen. LBC weather. After a generally dry night, Monday will be drier and brighter with a gentle breeze. One or two light showers across England and Wales during the afternoon and highs of 24. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Matt Hewitt.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Richard Spur.
Good morning. Should Sir Starmer move to the left to save his political skin? That's the question for you this morning. As dissatisfaction among MPs has, we read in The Guardian, created now a very febrile mood, with ambitious cabinet ministers already assessing their own options and position. A lesson in comms for any prime minister. When asked whether you will serve another term, try to express some enthusiasm at the prospect, reads this editorial. When at the end of his first term, David Cameron breezily told a reporter he would not serve a third, he inadvertently fired the starting gun for leadership, jostling between his potential successors. Keir Starmer fell into the same trap, says The Guardian, this month when he was asked whether he would fight the next election. You're getting way ahead of me, he said. Now, Jeremy Corbyn has suggested that his new party may end up being called Your Party. Your Party. After all, as sign-ups for his new group now approach 500,000 already, and it hasn't even launched. The former Labour leader announced the launch of his party, which does not yet officially exist, along with the co-founder, Zara Sultana, on Thursday. The pair invited voters to register their interest via the website uparty.uk, prompting many to believe the group's name was Your Party. But that idea appeared to be quashed when Ms. Sultana wrote on X, it's not called Your Party. Well, whatever it's called. The fact is that it is causing an enormous amount of interest, not least of all amongst those disaffected Labour voters who have really felt homeless politically since Keir Starmer came to power, given his political move to the right, his undoubted move to the right. The likes, of course, of Diane Abbott and others will be clamouring, no doubt, at the door of Mr. Corbyn to join. And momentum continued over the weekend when Ms. Sultana revealed that 450 people had additionally signed up to fight back. Now, as far as I can see, what this is edging up to be is a fight on two fronts for Keir Starmer. To the right, he has Mr. Farage and Reform UK, with their policies on immigration, their ideas about partial privatisation of the NHS, their ideas on income tax, for example, raising the threshold before you pay tax to £25,000. That would be very popular indeed. On the other front, you have this new movement spearheaded by Jeremy Corbyn, offering an alternative to those Labour voters who simply feel that the Labour Party they knew and maybe voted for generations, as did their fathers and forefathers and mothers and foremothers before them, has really vanished. And they don't have an alternative. Perhaps the Green Party, but they don't have a mainstream alternative party for whom to vote. This morning, I want you to call me and tell me whether you feel Mr. Starmer needs to change, and change very quickly, his political direction in order to preserve his premiership. Perhaps you don't think he will or should be there at the next election, and to preserve the Labour Party in its current incarnation, given that it's hemorrhaging both to the right and to the left, and you just wonder how much support is going to be left. What policies need to change, and how do they need to change to make Keir Starmer's party still have some semblance of a Labour Party in the old-fashioned sense? And what would it take for you personally to be won back to Mr. Starmer, his cabinet, and the party that he now governs? 0345 6060 973. I want to tell you to tell me what you feel needs to happen in order to gain back perhaps your support if you're a former and lapsed Labour voter, and to attract new voters if indeed Sir Keir Starmer is to survive. Now, Joe Twyman from Delta Poll spoke to Natasha Devon on LBC about whether there is a place for a party on the left.
I think there's certainly a place. The question of whether that is within one of the established parties or whether it is a breakout party, I think, remains to be seen. The electoral system and really the whole structure of British politics lends itself to the two main parties. And as we have seen repeatedly, parties that, and as I say, whether it's the SDP or Change UK or various other, or the Workers' Party for George Galloway, for instance, and before that, the Respect Party for George Galloway. These are left-wing populist movements that, indeed, under Galloway, have won by-elections, but they have consistently found it difficult to break through to that next stage, where you need not just people signing up, but you need boots on the ground, you need an infrastructure, you need all these sorts of operations that are difficult to build and take time to build. And people say, well, reform is only a few years old, and while that is true, it very much inherits the structure and the procedures and the processes from the Brexit Party and UKIP before that, and most obviously it inherits their leader as well.
And Samuel Sweek, spokesperson for the Peace and Justice Project, a campaign group founded by Jeremy Corbyn, says this is happening because of the failings of Keir Starmer's Labour Party.
That the Labour Party is the one who has lost this significant polling lead. It's the Labour Party that continues to pander to Nigel Farage's rhetoric on refugees and immigrants. And what the as of yet unnamed your party represents is a hopeful alternative to that, which will not look at demonising people in our communities, but rather embracing them and supporting them. That doesn't just speak to potential Labour voters going to reform, but that speaks to people already voting or thinking about voting for reform.
That's an interesting point that Samuel Sweek makes there, isn't it? This idea that some people feel that not only don't they have support for their views in the Labour Party, but in fact their left of centre stance is causing them to be demonised. That's a very strong word. Now, here's an interesting slant on it as well. This is from with The Guardian. This is from The Telegraph over the weekend. And it really reflects on what Mr. Trump and Sir Keir Starmer are doing this weekend. It says, Sir Keir Starmer has until now struggled to cut through as a leader. His vow upon entering office to oversee a return of politics to public service was soon derailed by a catastrophic budget, broken public services, overflowing prisons, and his inability to take a grip on immigration. His war on private schools and his tax rises infuriated Middle England. His attacks on farmers.